technically, we do not have a quorum. And so, but we're going to be in a hurry. We got a lot of people here from far away, and we would like to get them on their way home. First bill is House File 1802 by Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill requests $80,000, and this is for a slight adjustment to the group residential housing rate for residents at the Center of Human Environment, which is in my district near Manoman, Minnesota. It serves a number of Twin Cities residents who suffer from homelessness, chemical dependency, developmental disabilities, or mental illness. And the majority actually are sent from the Twin Cities all the way up to my district to receive this care and treatment. I can attest to the good work that the staff do for Minnesotans who are struggling to get their lives back on track. But it's been a financial struggle to maintain the current level of care that they have. I would ask that you give House File 1802 serious consideration and to see if you can find some way to assist our fellow Minnesotans up in Manoman and those from the cities who are depending on it. This actually saves a great deal of money for the state when you consider the effectiveness of the treatment that they're receiving up there. And with that, I do have three different people who have come to testify with me today. First of all, Mr. Darby Miller, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Human Development, and also two residents of the center. And I'd like it now to turn it over to Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darby Miller. I am the Executive Director of the Center of Human Environment, which is based right outside the town of Manoman. I am asking you to please support House File 1802 and help these Minnesotans who require help in recovery. The Center of Human Environment is a country home for adults with special needs such as chronic alcoholism, serious and persistent mental illness, and developmental disabilities. The Center of Human Environment opened its doors April 1, 2003, which houses 28 males and females from all over the state, with the majority coming from the city's area. The Center of Human Environment takes the worst alcoholics Minnesota has to offer, the ones that no one else wants, the people that do not respond to treatments and that have been in and out of treatments 10, 20, 30 times. The center is a board and lodge that takes chronic alcoholics and homeless off the streets to keep them safe and sober. These residents are the ones that spend most of their time in treatments, ER, detox. Our average age for residents is 50 years old because they have struggled to make it through treatments time and time again. The average stay of a resident is about 2 years. Besides the regular types of treatments offered, like our weekly AA meetings, we take a different approach to helping these residents through community volunteer work and recreational therapeutic activities. Adopting a highway for cleanup or setting up the local Lions Club programs are examples of community services we do. Recreational therapy includes many outdoor activities like raising pheasants for release, gardening, woodworking, canoeing, and hiking. This gives the residents a sense of self-worth and helps them feel better about themselves and makes the road to recovery quicker and easier path. But without a funding increase, the recreational therapy activities would significantly be reduced or eliminated. In these activities that help residents stay focused on occupied while trying to battle through the various stages of recovery. The success of this therapy is known around the state, resulting in a waiting list now of 10 people with an average of 3 to 4 month wait. If activities aren't reduced, additional staff hours would have to be cut. But staff have already been reduced, and there are no health benefits, and salaries have not been increased in several years. We are a 501c3 nonprofit that has been struggling to stay afloat. A few operations grants have kept us going, but they too have been reduced and will be exhausted in the next year. If we got this extra money, our problems would be solved. This $80,690 extra dollars a year would take care of our worries. Here's another way to look at the situation. For the 28 residents I have now, the state pays $23,747 a month on average. Based on the average number of detox visits, ER visits, and treatments for the 28 residents, the state would have to pay $204,672 per month for the residents if they were not in our facility. That is a savings of $180,924 in 1 month. That is more than double in 1 month that is being proposed in House File 1802 for the annual increase. Henry and Tracy came to me January 22, 2010, where they were staying in detox every day in order to stay off the streets. Henry has 404 detox admissions, with each admission 3 days for a total of 1,212 days in detox in Hennepin County. An average detox visit costs $370 a day, but Henry's cost in Hennepin County would be about $250 a day. That still has cost the state more than $300,000 for Henry alone. Tracy has 98 admissions with 294 days in detox, which has cost the state $73,500 at $250 a day. Since they have been at the center, they have both been safe, sober, off the streets, with no detox visits since January 22nd, the day they arrived. By only these two residents being at our facility since January, the center has saved the state $41,500, which is half of what I'm asking for in the year. In a couple months with just these two residents, I would have saved the state the amount of money I'm asking for in 1 year. This is why it is so important that I get this service increase. Spend a little money on the center, and I will save the state lots of money. Please support House File 1802 bill, and it will be one of the best things for you to do in order to save the state money. I thank the members of the Finance Division and also Representative Ken Eakin for assistance in this bill.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could ask the two residents to step forward and testify.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Manzel and Ms. Munson.
And if you would, when you start, state your name. We use that on the tape to know who's talking.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tracy Munson. I am a resident at the Center of Human Environment. And I'll just start by saying that I have been homeless for the past 5 years. Living on the streets has been very rough. It's very tiring. I've been beat up. I've been mugged. I've been in and out of detoxes numerous times. My life on the streets basically came down to living day by day, and all I had was a survival mode. I had nothing else. Once I became a resident at the Center of Human Environment, they have given me the opportunity to change my life around. They have provided me with things that I like to do, activities in which helps me learn how to live life sober again. And without those activities, we would not be able to, you know, learn how to live on the outside. And also, they take you as an individual. You are no longer a number. You are no longer a statistic while you are staying in this facility. You are treated like family when you are here, and that is very important when a person who is coming from absolutely nothing, and when you're in this place, you have something. You have something to look forward to. They help you set up the blueprints. So when you walk out of those doors, you are able to follow through with the goals that you would like to achieve for yourself. And I would like to be able to go back to school once I leave the facility and eventually open up my own small business. So I find this place is probably one of the best places that I have ever been into, and I have been in about 15 different programs, and this is far by the best program that I've ever been in.
Thank you. Mr. Mansell.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Henry Mansell, and I'm also a resident at the center. Prior to this, I've been homeless for almost 25 years. Maybe to get rid of some of the stereotypes of homelessness, I also have a master's degree in psychology and a bachelor's degree from St. John's. I was state-raised primarily, so I kind of struggled to get through school and to get, you know, make it on my own because I am an alcoholic. But for the last, since the late 80s, I've actually lived on the streets. I've been in and out of some programs, usually didn't make it in any of them. For the most part, Mr. Miller said, I've had 400 admissions to detox, and that was basically where I lived. Because there was nothing else. This is the first place that I've ever been. First of all, it takes me out of the cities, out of this environment that sucks me back in over and over again. I've been there since January, and I'm probably healthier than I've been in I don't know how many years. I feel good. I've also, since I've been there, I've also registered to go back to school at the University of Phoenix online. I have hope. I intend to stay there at least a year, if not longer, complete another degree and come back out and somewhere help the homeless. There are many, many men and women like myself, especially on the streets of Minneapolis, that I know of personally that have hundreds of admissions to detox. And it's a lot of money. And what we're asking for is a small increase to help us keep our residents involved and active, giving them hope, helping them build their self-esteem. It's saving my life. It's saving Tracy's life. I knew her out there. I watched her get beat up. I didn't actually see her get beat up, but I watched the results. I'm glad we're both here, and it's saving our lives, and I just would hope you would support this funding increase. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for Representative Abler?
Maybe for the author or for the... Thank you for coming, by the way, to both of you. I appreciate that. I have a question for your director, maybe to the author. Can you just give us an overview of... I see your funding is... $23,000, but can you just tell us how you're funded? And just in brief, I don't know how much time you plan to spend on this, but it's informational. But like you talk about money the state would save. A lot of times that's county money, and so have you taken the time to split out the county savings and state savings? And can you kind of enlighten me about that,
Mr. Chair, Representative? The money that comes from the county, we are GRH funded, which is group residential housing funding. We get a check from the county, which in large comes from the state, the big pot. Each county pays a GRH. I came up with that 23,000, whatever it was, for an average for the year. A lot of the residents there are on Social Security, so a big portion of their payment to the center is using their Social Security. Some might pay $1,200 for Social Security and $100 from the county GRH funding. So that's why it's less than $1,000 a person to stay there, which is through GRH funding.
Okay. Representative Abler.
All right, and so you're looking for a bump on the GRH thing.
GRH, the increase, the service increase.
Right, and so, but in the savings part, at least as this comes, if it's informational, there's a hint there that this isn't going to happen this year, but unless there's something beyond this that I know, but at least that's the inference I would send you home with. But as you want to get a fiscal note to see what this really would cost us, so if we give you what you ask, which is $80,000 or whatever, there will be some state savings potentially where that we wouldn't incur. At some point, you have to persuade there's a man behind the curtain who names Mr. Hoffman, who analyzes your assertions and then puts them into dollars and cents. But it would be productive for the author and the director to sit down with some fiscal staff and see what your county savings, what your state savings, and if it saves the county money, they should just give you more money. If they're going to save money net, if they're doing the detox and so on, and it may, if a lot of these savings are county savings, they might be where they would just be part of the host county or some other counties. There might be a way to look at this as a bigger thing. there's so many silos, and you're where the money is here, and you can't spend that money somewhere else. And just advice, on if that help. You don't have to respond to that so much. Just it's meant to be a conceptual help to you all.
Okay. Okay. And Mr. Miller, just to get things clear, in my mind, are the folks that are in your facility, are they also, are they on MA or GAMC, or on GA?
Yes, both. Mr. Chair, both are GMAC, MA. Most of our residents are the poverty. We are a low-income facility funded with tax credits to build our facility, and GRH funded now. So when you, I have 19 of the 28, I believe, are homeless. So yes, all but two of my people are on either GA or GMAC. Only two are self-pay. So yeah, majority are.
Any other questions? Well, I think what I'm going to do is I will move House File 1802 be recommended to pass, and then I would move that it be all those in. That's right. Call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum. And. I move House File 1802, and then I would move that House File 1802 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I think that's fine, just that it was published as informational, but I think this is, there must be a bunch of projects like this across the state that are really good, and they're just caught in the crosshairs of. They save a lot of money. If they would go away, it would cost us more. But it's kind of hard to document. Maybe if you think about putting this in your bill, and I don't know that I would mind that, that I think the author and the department should sit down with their county counterparts and see just what this $80,000 would really cost us. It might actually be free, as the director may think, and it may be a county savings, which then the counties could be encouraged to share in that pot. So, thanks.
And Mr. Miller, It's the home county of these people that pays you, or is it your county up there?
Correct. It comes from, Mr. Chair, the money comes from the GRH, from the county, which comes from the state.
We have a similar facility. Well, it's not really similar. It's a completely different model in my hometown of Duluth. And the biggest supporters of it are the police department. Because they don't have to arrest these people, they don't have to take them to detox centers. It saves the city a lot of money, even though the city is not really funding that facility.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's saving everybody money. It saves everybody money, and the main thing is it's keeping these residents safe, sober, off the streets, place to live. Place to get better and heal. And we are far out in the country, so the accessibility to alcohol or these influences aren't as easy. I tell them, tell the residents, they got to go through about 10 miles of cow pasture and barbed wire fence to get to town. And it is a smaller town, and it's very hard to get alcohol or to use. I think what makes us different from the other facilities is we are far out in the country. Our insurances are almost double than people in the city. And it was explained to me by the insurance company, you have a fire out there, your place is going to burn to the ground before anybody gets there. That's why our insurance is so high. We have a pond, we have water, liabilities, more insurance. I think we pay more than probably the other facilities in these insurances. We don't, our wages are bad. We don't have any benefits whatsoever. The pay starts out around $7.75 an hour, and you're working with hard, challenging people. And it's just year by year, we've been barely making it, and through these grants, they're going to be cutting us off.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Miller, and thank you, Representative Eakin. Next, we have an informational hearing on House File 3631, Representative Seiler.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today, I put before you House File 3631, which is asking for an increase in the daily rate for the ICF, the Intermediate Care Facility for the Developmentally Disabled in Bagley. And I have with me today Don Bluflot, who is the administrator of this facility, to share with all of you what they're going through at this facility and what will happen if this facility is no longer around, which is a very likely possibility within the next year or two due to the lack of funding. I have been to this facility, and the residents are wonderful people. I really enjoy seeing them. I see them around town in Bagley, and the staff does a great job with them. I have grave concerns for what would happen for these people. Where will they go when only three or four of them have families? And those are somewhat shirt tail. I just don't know where they would go if this facility closes. So with that, I will turn this over to Mr. Bluflot.
Mr. Bluflot, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Don Bluflot, and I'd like to thank the chairman and the other members of the committee for allowing me to speak. I've been with Pine Ridge Residence since its inception in 1975. I was hired out of college, kind of a late entry to college, but I finally made it through, and they hired me to start a group home for the mentally retarded at that time, developmentally disabled now or whatever. We've always been very, very tax conscious. My board has always run things as cheaply as humanly possible because they're concerned not only about the county tax dollar, but the state and the federal tax dollar. And now it's kind of catching up with us. 2008, after cuts and cost of living increases to rates that didn't really keep up with everything. But in 2008, we lost $18,161 plus a little, and we cut $24,600 and something from the 2009 budget, but we also got another 2.58% cut, and we went down a little over $19,000 with that. And I figured out for 2010, we cut as much as we possibly could out of the 2010 budget. And when I subtract away other income that we have, reimbursements and food stamps and different things like that, it comes down to $664,000 yet. And that divided by the number of resident days that we have with the 15 residents comes to $121.78 just to maybe break even for this year. And with the cuts and everything, we're down to $112.73. And we're just not able to make it. We have quite a bit of salary. $484,800 is salary for the workers that we have. We have, four that have been there 26 plus years, two that have been there 21 to 25 years, two for 16 to 20 years, four for 11 to 15 years, six for 6 to 10 years, and just four that are 1 year or less. And they all live in Clearwater County, so we're quite a boost to the economy there, and I think it would be awful if we had to close down, but we don't have much money left. I just cashed in one CD last week so we can continue to have a cash flow thing. And I know the timing is bad, but I kept hoping that the state would realize that residents like ours age and their needs increase at a rate that's much faster than the so-called normal population. And, I don't know, we just, as they age, it gets to be so bad that, and like I say, we have, of the 15 Class A residents, we have three that are Class B. Class A beds 2 years ago, as of April 1st, 2008, averaged $180.59 in the state of Minnesota. And we get 112, so you can see we're way under the average of things. And if we had to close down, there's been a moratorium on waiver homes, so there's no alternative housing available in Clearwater County. So our residents would be forced to move away from what family they have left in Clearwater County and be scattered out through the state. I don't know how else you know, they would be able to do that. We fought as a corporation of starting a waiver home and putting four of the more needy residents in that and building it somewhat close so they could still visit. But with the moratorium on waiver homes, we can't do that. So it seems like a very bad situation for our residents who are at the mercy of the state. And it's not only unfair to me, to them, but it's very cruel for them too, I think. And I'd appreciate your support of Senator Saylor, or Representative Saylor's bill. It's House File 3631, and it would really help us out and allow us to continue to operate, and I'd appreciate all of your concerns.
Okay, and Mr. Bluefillette, what's the turnover rate of your employees? I mean, I know you don't have a very good economy up there anyway, but...
Our turnover rate is very small. We have a lot of turnover in the part-time people that fill in for the full-time people and the regularly scheduled part-time people because it's all evenings and weekend work. It's not the most desirable. And it's getting people ready for bed and then helping them get up in the morning. And those are the heavy cleanup times for those that are older and not as well in control of themselves as some. So it's not the most desirable job. But even at that, we just have four that are 1 year or less employment. So I think it... Once they get there, they get attached to the people as I have. I started out as a college intern in 1972, and I've been there ever since because I got attached to the people. And working for a nonprofit isn't the best. I wouldn't give that advice, I guess, if somebody wanted to make the most out of their life and money-wise, but... enrichment in other ways, I would certainly recommend it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Abler.
Thank you. I don't know if which of you knows the answer, but is this all state money, Mr. Bluefillette, or
it's all Stone? Medicare money for the most part. The county pays, well, it used to be 4%. They've been playing around with that. I'm not sure just what the percent is now the county pays, but.
Did you say Medicare or Medicaid?
Medicaid, I'm sorry, yeah, Medicaid.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification. And so how do your rates compare with other rates anywhere else? Are they lower than most?
I think we're the second lowest in the state. The state average for Class A homes is $180, and we're $112-something. We also have three Class B beds in the lower level of our facility, and they're much higher. I think it's around $240 or $250 a day on an average for Class B, and we get the same as we do for the Class A bed, which is $112.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, Representative Saylor, I've got a great deal of sympathy for your situation. I've sat in this committee for 12 years, and the low rate prisoners of history homes that try to do anything just always struggle. I don't know if you could persuade Mr. Hoffman that if you were going to close, it would cost more to go anywhere else. That'd be the argument I'd make. And I don't know. It's just too bad the way you calculate our funding that you have to close, and then we say, "Oh, gee, that was expensive to us." But but it seems persuasive to me that these lowest homes trying to get by and serve people on paying people wages that guarantees they're in poverty. I mean, $12 is your high paid employee after 26 years. You're not wasting a lot of money on them. But I don't know what. Is there any way we can help these kind of? There's no. The money is so short. I understand that, but there's some places that are at the 95th percentile of the per diem, and they think they're challenged, but they're not challenged at all compared to you.
I know a new waiver home. I talked to our county social service director, and she said it starts out at $120 a day and then goes up depending upon their need. And, you know, 90% of ours would be much higher than $120 a day. So if we had to close up, the state or whatever would be paying much, much more for their care than what we would need in this bill to survive.
And Mr. Chair, what's the fiscal note on this bill? You know,
this is just here for information.
But what would it be if we funded it?
I don't think we have a fiscal.
You know, Senator Saylor, how much your fiscal note is?
I think it would be about $109,000, somewhere in there.
Representative Aver and Mr. Chair, we could find that out for you. I don't know at this moment.
Oh, it's a good thing. You can talk to me later. Thanks.
Well,
I think it's $20 a day, basically, in the bill, and we have 5,475 resident days. I think it's somewhere in $109,000, $110,000.
Any other questions? Don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Coonan. Yep. And while he's coming down, I would move House File 3571 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Coonan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Coonan, excuse me. We'll get it right.
Thank you. Say, I also have an amendment, too, that I would like to have the committee move.
Okay, I would move the A2 amendment then. You want to describe the amendment?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I'm moving the A2 amendment, or is this just technical and you want to?
No, I can explain the amendment if you need to. What the bill does is authorizes publicly owned nursing facilities to move up to the full rebased payment rate. And what the amendment does is, I should back up and explain. I have a nursing home in Clarkville, Minnesota that's publicly owned. It's owned by the city, but they hire a private management firm to operate the nursing home. And so what this amendment does is include nursing homes that are under that type of situation.
No, you're going to have to explain that to me now. There is a city-owned facility, but they hire a private manager, which is fine.
Yeah, it's a.
But why does that make their situation any different?
I think this amendment was added in the Senate, and I think their reasoning was that. It kind of lowers the bar, so if the city just owns the physical plant or are the license holder, and so it kind of leaves out the management part of the nursing home then. So in Clarkfield's situation where they hire a private management firm to operate the nursing home, the city still owns the physical plant.
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So back to the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the bill does then is authorize a rate increase for publicly owned nursing facilities, and this is up to the full rebase payment rate. If the local government entity owning the facility agrees to pay the state the non-federal share of the rate increase, or in other words, the state share of the rate increase. Section 1 lays out the method by which the local governments are to pay the state and the non-federal share of the costs of the rate increase, and payments of the non-federal share will be made monthly to the commissioner due the 15th of the following month. This alternative to the phase-in rebate payment rate, in other words, what this bill does, the rate will take effect beginning January 1st, 2011, based on cost reports for the year ending in September 30th of 2009. And future rate years, rates will take effect on October 1st of each year based on the most recent available cost report. And the eligible nursing facilities that want to participate will need to make an application to the commissioner by September 30th of 2010, and participation is irrevocable. If a nursing facility applies for this alternative to the phased-in rebase rate and the result is no rate increase, no payment by the local government entity is required at that point. If the commissioner determines that the payments will cause the rates to exceed the state's Medicare upper payment limit or any other federal limitation for that matter, the commissioner will reduce the payment rates and the non-federal share that is owed by the local government entities by the appropriate percentage. And in this bill, local government entities refer to cities, counties, and hospital districts. And that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Coonan, I assume that the local unit of government has approved this?
This bill is optional, so the local units of government will have to decide if they want to be involved in this or not.
Okay. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Coonan, what happens, what happens to private pay clients under this? What happens to their payment structure?
From what I understand, that it's possible that their payments could go up some, and if homes have enough private pay, they may not want to get involved with this because of worry about losing clients or residents at the home.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coonan, I don't know if I'm especially not with it today or what, but I'm just trying to figure out what you're trying to do here. And are you just basically trying to allow local governments a way to improve their nursing home if they're willing to pitch in to do it? Is that kind of the idea here?
That's pretty much it. It's volunteer, and if the local units of government want to do this to help funding for their nursing homes, they'll have to pay the state share, so there is no cost to the state, but there will be cost to the local government. In some cases, some local units of government are putting some money into their nursing homes to keep them afloat anyway, and I'm sure that this option would be a lot more desirable to them since they're already doing that.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And, you know, Representative Coonan, this sounds like an admirable thing to do in the sense that, you know, it gives more local flexibility and so on. But I wonder, have you got buy-in from all the various entities that would be representing local governments? Because the thing that I wonder if what we could end up having happen here is that over time we end up basically forcing local governments, you know, who are after all under pressure from their local residents, to take more and more of the burden of the nursing homes. And obviously when local governments or counties fund things, it basically operates as a shift to property taxes. And while I you know, like the idea that, you know, if people in a local area are really committed to their nursing home and want to pay more to make it better, that they could do that. But I just have some concern of how this changes our system, because it seems like it might be a pretty big change.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, and I think you're right, this is a shift to local property tax, and for those who would like to see all state funding, that's not very appealing. But when you look at local communities and their nursing homes, for some of them, they're pretty important and they want to keep them there. This bill does not have a sunset, but the full the rebasing should be phased in by, what is it, October of 2015. So at that point, this bill doesn't mean anything anymore anyway. So it's not a continuous ongoing thing. But you're right. You brought up a good point. That is an issue. But, you know, many of these communities and their nursing homes feel like they got their backs up against the walls, and they're, you know, if it's important enough to them that they have this option.
Further questions? Representative Abler.
Interesting to have rate day here at the committee. Actually, I think it's an intriguing idea. I had never thought of this. And, you know, to Representative Liebling's points, those are well taken. I think some cities or counties really like having a nursing home open in their district. I think we heard from two groups here they're likely to go away if we're not careful. And so they would have to look at their taxpayers and ask them, well, what do you think? And are these county-owned, most of these?
Well, the bill includes city-owned, county-owned, and hospital districts that operate nursing facilities.
And so do they, Mr. Chair, do they pay property taxes or in lieu of property taxes?
Mr. Chairman, do you mean
the building, the nursing homes themselves? Do they, in their budget, do they allocate something for what would be thought of as property tax?
No, anything owned by a government doesn't pay, and nonprofits don't pay either. But this doesn't include nonprofits today either. But no, there's no property tax.
All right. When I would, I can just think a lot of reasons you'd want to do this. You'd want to keep 100 employees working in your town so they can go to the gas station and buy food and actually pay their own property taxes from the houses that would otherwise be vacant. Is there a reason this would be limited to only publicly owned ones? And the first group didn't probably qualify because they're just on state group GRH, but the one that's getting Medicaid money. Is there a reason this could be done for a private group, that the county could chip in something if they would agree that that was a valuable thing to do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I really can't answer that question. I'm assuming this one was the easiest, is why, yeah, why Senator Kubi and I are working on this first, but I really can't answer your question on how far this could go.
Mr. Chair, and is the department going to testify on this one? Might be easy. If they want to, it'd be interesting to hear what they're thinking about this, and while they're coming, if they're... Somebody here from there.
Anybody here would like to?
Okay.
And Mr. Chair,
while they're, oh, do you want to? We're facing a time of very flat funding at best for this whole industry, and you know, it's interesting to try to build part of that on some federal funding, which has got deficits as far as the eye can see, and at least they can still print money. So that's, but I hope that I think at some point we got to redesign some of this stuff, because everybody's going out of business that we hear, you know. So thanks, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Tabell. I'm from the Department of Human Services. Could you please restate what exactly was the question you were looking from the department?
Spell, was it?
Tabell.
Tabell, thanks. Welcome to the committee. Well, can you just give us your view of this idea?
Well, the idea behind this bill comes from years ago when there was something called the intergovernmental transfer, and that involved county facilities only, and certain county facilities. And that was a payment that was made by the county to the state, and then the state turned around and made a payment back to the county and collected federal share on that payment. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, took great exception with that plan and would not approve any state plans for five consecutive years until it was finally agreed that we would no longer do that. Their big hang-up on it was that the facilities didn't actually benefit from that payment. It was a payment between the state and the counties, and there was no additional money for care. This puts the money in the facility, and the county or the city, whichever, makes the payment back to the state to cover the state's cost of the rate adjustment. So the money stays with the facility.
So, Mr. Chair, so does the department think this is a good idea? And if it was in a bill, would you say great?
Well, it didn't make it into the governor's proposal, I can tell you that much. I don't know that, I don't know what the governor's position would be on something like this.
All right. So, this, Mr. Chair, sometimes it's our mission to encourage him to look at new ideas. Is the department, I mean, you're different than the governor. I mean, is the department think this is an improvement over the other thing that was found to be a problem? And is there some merit to this?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the merit to this is that the money does stay with the facility. There are many facilities out there that are run by a county or a city where the government is subsidizing that nursing home. And this, what this bill does is allows, what it does is takes federal money and gives it to the facility to help offset some of those losses. And that's why it's voluntary. If your facility is not losing money, then you don't have to participate in the program. If you are losing money, then you might want to consider doing this. There was the question that was brought up about private pay, and that is a consideration. If you've got a lot of private pay, you may not want to participate in this, even if you are losing money, because then your private pay may go to other facilities where rates are lower, and then you lose even more money.
Just one more question. Well,
Representative.
Well, I think I'm kind of interested in this, just as a way to help some of these places like stay open. Is this only for publicly owned things, or could a county chip in the share for a privately owned ICFMR and take care of its share and have a different kind of bill written for them?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I believe this would work on an ICFMR program as well as a nursing facility. Whether it would work for non-governmentally owned facilities, I hadn't considered that before. It's possible, but I couldn't say for certain without having a little more time to think about that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler.
Could you check on that and let us know?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to sort of respond to Representative Abler. I'm not saying I think it's a bad idea. It's a new idea to me, and I think it's a really interesting, intriguing idea. I'm kind of wondering, Representative Coonan, if you know, or maybe the our testifier from the department knows, can publicly owned nursing facilities raise funds the way privately owned ones can? I mean, just do, you know, charitable fundraising to help support their activities, or don't they?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I don't know of any fundraising done by municipally owned or county owned facilities. I don't see why they couldn't, but I just don't know of any specific cases where that goes on.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, so just to finish off, I mean, because that is something that some privately owned or charitably owned nonprofit nursing homes do that, and they are able to, you know, make things just a bit better by doing that. And I think this is a very intriguing idea. And thank you for bringing the bill.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3571 be recommended to pass and sent to the overall Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nope.
Okay. Next on the agenda is a discussion of the GAMC reform bill and whether it's working and how the various care organizations are responding to that. And first we have Stephanie Radke from the Department of Human Services.
Good Stephanie Radke, DHS. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am here to present on the implementation of the new JMC program, including creation of the hospital-based coordinated care delivery systems. As you recall, this legislation was passed March 25th and signed by the governor March 26th. I preface my comments by recognizing the degree of change presented in this law in a compressed implementation time frame. It has been 3 weeks since the legislation was passed, and June 1st is just over 6 weeks away. Significant implementation planning is underway, but there are many details that will not be final for several weeks. That said, I will provide a high-level overview of the implementation work underway and may need to defer answers on more specific questions. This law is a result of the March 5th agreement between legislators and the administration to reshape the GAMC program in response to the current deficit. It contains a reduction in funding and the following major provisions. First, a two-month fee-for-service GAMC bridge for April and May. Secondly, elimination of the transitional Minnesota Care program and changes in GAMC eligibility effective April 1st. Third, creation of hospital-based coordinated care delivery systems, which will be responsible for delivering healthcare services to people eligible for GAMC beginning June 1st. Next, a creation of a temporary uncompensated care pool for non-CCDS hospitals. And finally, creation of an outpatient prescription drug reimbursement pool. The department has grouped implementation efforts for this law into two broad categories. Those changes taking place April 1st and those June 1st. The department issued a bulletin on April 1st titled 2010 Legislative Changes to General Assistance Medical Care, GAMC, that rescinded earlier direction on GAMC and provides instructions on eligibility and benefit changes under this new law with April 1st effective dates. This bulletin covered the elimination of GAMC qualifiers for applications received on and after April 1st of this year. Secondly, the elimination of transitional Minnesota care effective for applications received on and after April 1st. The elimination of GAMC hospital-only GHO eligibility for applications received on and after April 1st. The continuation of GAMC for enrollees on and after April 1st. The continuation of transitional Minnesota care for enrollees on and after Minnesota care, on and after April 1st. And the continuation of GHO for enrollees who remain hospitalized on and after April 1st. We also notified partners in this bulletin of the fee-for-service benefits for all GAMC enrollees for April and May. And a notice, and we also included the notice sent to GAMC enrollees notifying them of the change in service delivery under fee-for-service. The department also reduced fee-for-service rates to 37% of previous fee-for-service rates effective April 1st. With regard to contracting for coordinated care delivery systems, we are on track to meet the June 1st implementation date. On April 1st, DHS sent draft contracts to the 17 hospitals that meet the statutory criteria for June 1st eligibility as a CCDS. A contractors' conference was held on April 6th, and signed contracts are due to be returned by the close of business on April 30th. This aggressive timeline will allow us to notify GAMC recipients of their CCDS options prior to the June 1st start of service delivery through a CCDS. Final determination of the CCDSs through the contract process will allow us to finalize the CCDS enrollment process and corresponding communications to clients, counties, hospitals, providers, and other stakeholders. The final disposition of CCDSs will also inform allocation of the temporary uncompensated care pool among the non-CCDS hospitals from June 1st through December 1st. Given these unknowns, work up to now has focused on designing the system specifications for payments to CCDS hospitals, payments to hospitals from the uncompensated care pool, and the functionality of the fee-for-service outpatient prescription drug pool. Planning has also begun on designing the new enrollment process and the necessary communications. We will be issuing another bulletin prior to June 1st with specific instructions once all of those details are in place. This is a brief summary of where implementation is at this time, and I'm able to answer questions at this point. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Radke? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Radke, I'm just wondering if you could share with us a little bit. I understand there have been providers in to meet with the department to talk a little bit about expectations, et cetera, and I'm wondering if you can give us a summary of maybe, I know it's always so hard to see who's been in and what the nature of those conversations have been like, please.
Ms. Radke.
Yes. Chair, Representative Murphy, Mr. Chair, we have met with a number of hospitals, and unfortunately, Karen Pete is unable to be with us today due to a family medical situation, and I understand the Hospital Association and others will be testifying later as well. I can say just very generally that in the conversations I've been in, that the providers and hospitals have stressed the need for flexibility in how they design their CCDS system in order to manage their own financial risk.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Ms. Radke. And I know Ms. Peds, you're not here, so you might not be able to answer this, but one of the things I've been hearing back from members with hospitals that are contemplating this law is that there's a lack of clarity in the law itself, and that the providers are trying to get some clarity out of DHS in terms of the expectations either in the uncompensated care pool or in the CCDS system, and I'm wondering if you could shed any light on that vein of questioning for us. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ms. Reg.
Absolutely. Work is underway in figuring out how all those pieces will work together, and I think there's a lot of interaction with who ends up becoming a CCDS, and so we will not have all the details in place of how all those pieces will work together, I think, until the contracting process is over at the end of this month. So as I noted earlier, I mean, we're sketching out a framework for implementation and identifying when certain pieces need to be complete, but all of the details aren't there yet.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just one final question. Thanks, Ms. Radke. I understand that the first round of contracts are due at the end of today. So do you think that it is the position of the department that once you know which facilities are interested in participating as a CCDS, that the clarity, would there be clarity then given to those that are willing to step up, or do you think those hospitals that sign a contract will then begin to shape and make more clear how the system works? Do you know how that next step in the process will be conducted?
Mr. Chair, that's Representative right. Murphy, you know, I think it depends on the questions and who's asking them. You know, we're trying to provide information, and we understand the tight time frame here in trying to provide information in as expedited manner as possible, but wanting to be sure that we're providing the final disposition, I think, is the challenge. So, I mean, we'll be providing information as quickly as we can.
I have a question about the, if someone is assigned to the CCDS and shows up at another hospital for an emergency treatment, the way the law is written, the CCDS would have to pay that hospital for that treatment if it's an emergency. And my question, so is that true? And secondly, if there's no official relationship between those two hospitals, how do they negotiate the price?
Mr. Chair, those are some of the details we are continuing to work through.
Any other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Radke. In your discussions with the hospitals and going back and forth with DHS, has any of the hospitals stated that they're either unwilling or unable to provide a proposal due to the time limits put forward in the bill?
Ms. Radke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I myself am not aware of any hospitals who have expressed concerns over they're expressing concern over the timeline, but have explicitly said that they will not be at CCDS because of the timeline. That does not mean that there aren't any, but I'm not aware of any.
Other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And next, we're going to go to Jerry Crest from St. Joseph's Hospital in Mankato. And he's also, I think, going to testify for Frank Iosi, since Emmanuel St. Joe's is a part of the Mayo system, and Mr. Iosi had a medical emergency himself today. Not life-threatening, is my understanding, but
right.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Jerome Crest, I'm the Chief Administrative Officer of Emmanuel St. Joseph's, part of the Mayo Health System based in Mankato, Minnesota. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a privilege for me to address you today and tell you a little bit about our decision. And just up front, I'll tell you that the decision by Emmanuel St. Joseph's and at this stage by Mayo Clinic, St. Mary's Medical Center in Rochester, is that we will not be CCDS organizations. We are the only two entities in southern Minnesota that were identified in the first go-round as potential CCDS organizations. So that does present an issue or a problem. For many years, Emmanuel St. Joseph's has been one of the larger providers of GAMC care for patients in the state. In fact, we're number 7 in the state in terms of size in GAMC. Reimbursement for the care we've rendered those patients has always been well below the actual cost of delivering the care, not the charge, but the cost of delivering that care. The recent legislation related to the delivery of care of this population is particularly troublesome for our organization. In essence, we're asked to function as an insurance company. If you think about the provisions of the law, it asks us to negotiate with others, and as somebody asked the question earlier, to potentially end up paying them for services. So we're asked to function that way as a clinical care delivery system under that structure. There are a number of problems with that. We're asked to take the total risk of care for any patients that are assigned to us. That's an insurance company function, again, I would repeat, and we're not in a position to do that. We're expected to negotiate financial arrangements with other providers who would theoretically function under our umbrella, but for whom we have no control or ability to foster more effective or efficient care. So we've got responsibility but no authority to deal with it. We're expected to set up a system to negotiate payment arrangements and pay others, a system we do not currently have, and frankly, which would be very expensive and time-consuming to implement. We are expected to add services, including non-medical services, to this population of consumers, but for less money than was available previously. In return, the state is offering to pay us about a third, of, as near as we can determine, of what we've historically received to care for this population. It does not cost us any less to produce the care for these patients than for any other patient. Substantially reduced reimbursement, while requiring addition of non-value added administrative expense, will not help these patients get better access to state to better care. It will not help us to be more effective and efficient organization or reduce health care costs in the state. In other words, it's not health care reform. It is strictly a payment mechanism. Other insured patients will be asked to shoulder the burden of another cost shift from governmental programs. Our conclusion was that we simply cannot assume the total risk and responsibility for this population while receiving significantly less than our cost of doing so. In spite of these concerns, we continue our commitment to provide needed services to this population and others needing our service, regardless of ability to pay. And that statement comes from Mayo Clinic as well as Emmanuel St. Joseph's. We would urge you to consider, as a much better approach, the adoption of the early enrollment option in Medicaid that has been offered in recent federal legislation for those under 75% of the federal poverty guidelines, and would urge you to find a way to make that possible. We just can't function under the rules or under the guidelines of the bill that has been passed at this point. I'd be more than happy to address any questions.
So, Mr. Crest, you're saying that you'd be better off financially to just accept the uncompensated care or go to the uncompensated care pool than to try to do it the other way.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct.
And I have another sort of, doesn't really relate to this, but your hospital was very high on GAMC in 1 year, if I understand it right. The year that was used for the base, 2007 or whatever it was, did something unusual happen that year?
No, Mr. Chairman, I believe we've been very high in GAMC multiple years. We're also the 10th lowest paid hospital in the state under medical assistance.
Okay, questions for Mr. Kress? Representative Abler.
All right, just to thank you for coming, and a lot of us understand this issue pretty well. So if nothing changes in current law and time goes by, how do you plan to absorb the costs of the people who will be coming to you, just besides just uncompensated? I mean, do you see yourself just doing what you did before? Are you going to be turning people away? Or what do you see in terms of the practical impact if you don't do this opportunity that's there now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what it will translate into over time is one of two things. Either we'll be facing many of the same challenges that the nursing homes you've heard earlier today are facing, or secondly, we will pass it on to others who are paying the bills. It'll be a hidden tax. I don't know of any other way to do it.
Thank you. Other questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and we appreciate it. Next is Mike Mahoney from Essentia. Well, welcome to the committee, and why don't you explain first what Essentia is and how many hospitals you represent in Minnesota.
Happy to do that, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Mahoney. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for Essentia Health. And within Essentia Health is St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, Brainerd Lakes Health, which is St. Joseph's Medical Center and the Brainerd Lakes Clinic, and Innovis Health in Fargo, and St. Mary's Innovis Health in Detroit Lakes. And so as I'm here before you today, my comments can be directly on the two specific CCDS-eligible facilities, which include St. Mary's Innovis Health in Detroit Lakes, and then more specifically and more profoundly, St. Mary's Medical Center, the flagship hospital of SMDC. But just behind that is SMDC Medical Center, the former city hospital, which is the former Miller Dwan Hospital, former public hospital. In 2008, St. Mary's Medical Center and the former Miller Dwan had a liability of $8 million for GAMC, and that was revenues that we received in one fiscal year. The current proposal reduces that allocation for services provided in our system in Duluth down to $2 million. And it also adds, through the additional liability of the entire northeast part of the state, the entire Arrowhead, a liability of $24 million. So this is a very serious issue for us, together with a competitive market, in particular St. Luke's Hospital, just four blocks down the road from us in Duluth. St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, and actually all of Essentia, does not have the ability to operationalize payment mechanisms with all of the referring facilities across the northern half of the state. And quite frankly, to the extent that St. Mary's Medical Center were to opt in, which we will not be doing, we would be putting in jeopardy the entire Essentia Health system, which was recognized by the executive committee of our board when the question came as far as how would we have the financial liability and where would the risk be borne and opting in as a CCDS. The risk is uncontrollable and unrealistic, and a $2 million does not make us bring us close to covering the liability that we would be asked to assume. In the discussions that we've had in Duluth, we feel that rather than reform effort, this creates an illusion of coverage in greater Minnesota, such that GAMC eligible individuals would really not have health care coverage. They would maintain only their pharmacy benefits, but they would be required to go to a hospital emergency room to receive those prescriptions and have them filled. The health plans are totally cut out of the management and risk of this, so it's a total shift of the entire liability and responsibility for the population. We also see this as contrary to the 2008 Minnesota Health Reform legislation, directing services to the highest cost component of the health system, initially hospitals, but more specifically to the emergency rooms. It also creates access problems across greater Minnesota. Specifically, keep in mind that St. Louis County has the third highest GAMC enrollment in the state, with only one eligible CCDS in the entire Arrowhead. Detroit Lakes, St. Mary's, and Novus Health in Detroit Lakes does not have the capacity to act in this fashion. Additionally, to the extent that we don't opt in, we recognize that the allocation that would be available to us, to our entire system, which amounts to $3 million, now gets redistributed among those who do opt in, primarily those entities in the metropolitan area that elect to opt in. We would then pursue our piece of the pie through the uncompensated care or charity care pool, together with other significant players across the state, so that we don't anticipate any significant reimbursement for the total services that we provide. And initially, there were a number of memos that I had sent out to members of this committee regarding our concerns. We feel that initially that if there is to be an uncompensated care pool, that it should be 100%, not with a carve-out specifically for those entities to opt in. We think that this should return to a patient-centered focus. To the extent that that doesn't happen, we think that for those CCDS-eligible facilities who don't opt in, those dollars should follow them to the charity care pool. And then lastly, and primarily, we do feel that the state should seriously consider the expansion and take the opportunity to enroll these individuals in the medical assistance that's now available through the health reform legislation passed on the national level. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Broad.
Thank you. And Mr. Mahoney, I'm just, can you tell me the population that you are serving with the GAMC population? The number. I must have missed that.
The number of individuals,
right.
It fluctuates from year to year.
Give me a rough.
The best way for us to track that is actually through the revenue system. And so the liability for Duluth alone was $8 million. In 2008.
Right. Mr. Chairman, and what I'm trying to get to is the cost per person and use the $3 million and how that breaks down.
Right.
Is there a rough guess or a rough number that you can give me related to the number of people?
I don't have a, as opposed to the number of people, I don't know. I also don't know the number of encounters that would match that same population. Not familiar with that. Not in Duluth, nor in Detroit Lakes or Brainerd.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
If that's possible to get, I think
that
would be very helpful.
Happy to track that down for
you. I'm trying to assess the costs and benefits and things like that. That'd be great. Thank you.
Happy to track that down.
And if you look at St. Louis County, the Iron Range cities have a population in that area that's at least equal, probably greater than what's in the city of Duluth. And this is the only eligible hospital in northeastern Minnesota. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mahoney, could you just refresh my memory on the GAMC negotiations as we were concluding those? There was a rate change specifically for Duluth that was requested and granted. Could you refresh my memory as to exactly what that was and what differences it made?
Mr. Mahoney.
The resulting impact for that change, and I anticipate you're referencing the change from not only being eligible for CCDS status, but going into the upper bucket of the 110%. The impact of that was approximately $150,000, which makes a minimal impact in the determination.
It would have been nice to know that at the time. when we were doing that, that you would not choose to become registered even with that additional money, and it is disappointing that we did not know that at the time, and certainly is disappointing coming back. There's a lot of talk about the MA nationalizing and trying to buy into that. We don't know if that's going to happen, certainly. With the uncompensated care pool, certainly you'll continue to see patients and care for them the best way that you can. But I think that there's a sort of a certainty with the MA changes that I don't necessarily know is real. Perhaps it is. But I think that certainly with the conclusion of the debate within the GAMC, we're obviously trying to do the best we could for folks all across the state and making accommodations for those in Duluth. Certainly would have been better to know that at the time, but I think in moving forward, we certainly want to make this work, and disappointed that you chose not to do that, and would certainly encourage you to reconsider.
Representative Thiessen's next, then Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have Fargo too?
Fargo too, correct.
So, and this is kind of a little bit off topic, but how? So Fargo serves most of that western part of the people live in Moorhead and around there. How does that work with the GAMC population?
Mr. Chair, through discussions with the Department of Human Services, it's our understanding that to the extent they're eligible or already enrolled in GAMC, wherever they reside, they would be assigned to the closest CCD facility, which in that case would have been Detroit Lakes, St. Mary's and Avis Health in Detroit Lakes.
So even though they use Fargo as their hospital, they would go to?
They would be referred to Detroit Lakes.
And this is just kind of the, and this would be true before the change and after too. How does that cross-state reimbursement work, or is there none? So people show up at Fargo, does the state of Minnesota pay for them?
Mr. Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, our facility in Fargo, in Avis Health, had been receiving reimbursement for GAMC enrollees.
But they wouldn't anymore.
They will not now.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up with what Representative Dean was talking about, and just to Representative Dean, if I understood that you're saying that the expansion of Medicaid is somehow uncertain, and I don't know what you're referring to. I'm kind of curious there, because I think that what our testifier is talking about is our right now in the federal law that was passed, that we have an option to start early on expanding Medicaid, and that we could cover this population that you all tried to cover with GAMC when this obviously wasn't available at that time, but now it is available. There's nothing uncertain about it if we find the money and decide to buy in. Is that what you're referring to, or was there something else that I'm not understanding?
Representative Dean.
Well, Representative Liebling, the money is not free. Certainly we can choose to do that, but it's going to come at great state cost, both in for the short term and the far term, and that's certainly a policy decision that we can make, and I think we're going to discuss a little bit later. But it is certainly not without costs. Federal dollars are matched state dollars, dollar for dollar, and that's something we can certainly do, but I don't know that it's something that we can afford to do, certainly not at the levels that are available.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Dean. I just wasn't sure if you meant that it was uncertain as to our witness whether that would be available to the hospitals, or whether you were saying that it was uncertain whether it would be available to us as a state if we chose to get it. But certainly you're right, we have to, it's not free, but if we as a state decide that that's a priority for us, it is available to us. There's, unlike some other federal money that's out there that we're all kind of hoping will be passed, or some of us are anyway. Thanks.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, and is it Dr. Mahoney or Mr. Mahoney?
Doctor of Law.
Oh.
Mike is fine.
Okay. guess I wish I knew you better. The talking to my hospital, which was, I'm not sure what they decided to do, but they were talking that they were, they were, it came up in our conversations between them and the commissioner, and I was trying to get them to jump on this deal. And I don't know what they decided as of today. That they could still partner with one of the other hospitals that's joined this deal and kind of be an outpost or something. And just given, I think that a lot of us thought that we could make this work, and my interest is in helping you serve people and not do it for free. Current law being what it is, you don't know that will change. That's the discussion we just had, that, you know, people have to agree. And and right now you have a current law, which is the one in front of us. And so have you considered, if you're not going to do this, have you considered later talking to Hennepin or Regions or somebody else to be a partner with them? So I got to think the uncompensated care pool is going to dry up pretty quick. But it seems like the expertise you would bring to serve the people in your area on some basis would be something you have you guys thought about that?
Mr. Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, we've discussed that internally to the point where across our system, across the northern half of the state, we have actually made efforts to beef up our charity care program to stabilize our organization in light of this legislation and in light of the unallotment that took place last year. I'm unfamiliar with the transfer pattern out of Detroit Lakes. The transfers from Brainerd either come to Duluth or down initially through St. Cloud. But Duluth is really a catch basin, too, for a good portion of the state. And so it's not with great frequency the transfers come from Duluth to the metro area.
So, Mr. I was busy on the first part of the presentation, but if there's a person who's a GMC person in Duluth who would be assigned to one of these groups that have done it but doesn't go there, it would seem like it'd be fair at some point that the people who are getting whatever money for that person would want to share it with you on some basis.
Mr. Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I think you raise a good question, and that is, to the extent, what exactly is a CCDS? Is a CCDS really a health plan? What's the limitation or the scope of their liability, and to what extent does that liability cover other transactions and relationships with referring entities? And to that extent, those same questions, the answers to those questions, aren't available through other CCDSs or even the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abel.
It just seems that I have an interest as a statewide policymaker, company as an interest as a neighbor, that the very question that drives you away from doing it may be what actually is something we have to address about what happens to care you provide to the people who should have gone to Hennepin or wherever else or some other done this. How do we handle that? Maybe at least a question to clarify for some legislative thing. If there's only one, if we don't decide, I don't know what happens. I haven't seen your bill. I don't know what the governor's going to think about it, and I don't know what you're going to propose. But it seems that the very thing we should clear up is some of these questions that are unanswered about allocating risk and some of these questions, that, or have the department make a ruling that we approve it.
And Mr. Chair, in making the decision not to, that wasn't an easy decision. For one thing, we will continue to provide the care for the patients that we serve. That's something that our board and our administration and our entire organization takes very seriously. To the extent we opt out, those dollars automatically flow to another facility that is eligible. And that's quite frankly, in our opinion, the insult to injury on this.
Mr. Chair, I was kind of getting at that. So some group is going to get a little extra money, then we need to find a way to take care of that. I think it's a gap in the law that just didn't get addressed that could be remedied yet.
Any further questions for Mr. Mahoney? Representative Giffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Mahoney, you're up in that area of Duluth, correct? And
correct.
It's been mentioning that you have patients coming from elsewhere, but you're also very close to Wisconsin, Superior, in fact, probably closer to them than anywhere else. Do you have records of these JMC patients? Are these all Minnesota people, or being so close to Wisconsin, you get a few of the Wisconsinites as well?
Mr. Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you asked. 30% of the services that we deliver in our system in Duluth are Wisconsin residents. Those Wisconsin residents are not Minnesota GAMC individuals. Minnesota GAMC is only a Minnesota resident program. 50% of our charity care flows to services that we deliver to Wisconsin residents. And we also pay a 1% or 2% provider tax on those services that are delivered in Duluth, but are of actual Wisconsin residents.
Representative Githmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems like we may have some responsibilities for our Minnesota residents, but, you know, we're not the federal government that deals with all the other states. So is this something that you've considered? I mean, is this possible? I mean, it seems like we have a fiduciary responsibility here, and especially when those services are also being paid for and taxed as well. It seems like that might lift a little bit of the load here if the focus were in particular on their care for Minnesota GAMC, and maybe you're very familiar with all this, so maybe you've tried this before, or maybe you have additional information.
We have the opposite problem on the western border. In the northwest, the big healthcare providers are in North Dakota, and in the southwest part of our state, the big providers are based in South Dakota.
Well, that's okay, Mr. Chairman. We've found that. Sorry. I'm here for Minnesotans.
But, Mr.
However, I do think that each state should, you know, either pay back or cost back. I just think in some way, shape, or form, but that's probably a little beyond our usual effort. I just thought it was a good question, maybe. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, though, the people come from Wisconsin bring their insurance with them, right?
If they have insurance.
If they have insurance, or if they're on a Wisconsin public program, you get reimbursed from Wisconsin, right?
Mr. Chair, for those individuals who are enrolled, however, Northwest Wisconsin is one of the greatest blighted areas in the country.
Right, but I don't know what the option would necessarily be. I guess we could tax Wisconsin, is what you're saying? like tax reciprocity, which
yes,
the governor got rid of?
Yes, I'm just thinking of some sort of reciprocity here. And if they're on GAMC, my question was specifically to GAMC, because that is not an insurance issue, whereas, I agree with you, wherever they come from, if they have insurance, and that's a whole different sort of thing. But this was those who do not in particular.
Representative Murphy is next, and then Broad, and then Leeway.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear the very beginning of Representative Kipmeyer's question, but you do have to be a resident of Minnesota to be eligible for GAMC.
Okay, Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to the tax reciprocity, if our friends wearing the triangle-shaped holy orange hats to our east would actually pay their bills, we wouldn't have reciprocity problems. And so if we enter into another reciprocity agreement with a state, we've got to figure out a way to make sure that they pay their bills, whether it's for health care or for taxes.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I understood the witness to say was that not only they provide the charity care to the Wisconsin, to some Wisconsin residents, but they pay the provider tax on that care that they give away. So, in a sense, the state is making some money on those people, right? We're not paying for their care, but we're sure making the money on the tax. And a large institution I'm very familiar with has exactly the same problem.
Let me ask you something, Mike. I hadn't thought about this before, but what if they can't pay? Do we pay the provider tax? Do you have to pay the provider tax, even if it's charity care?
Mr. Chair, we pay the provider tax on all services that are provided and the value of that. So to the extent, and maybe this can, you know, be clarified further, but no matter where, what resident the person is, what state residency.
So you apply a charge to that individual if they can't pay, and then you have to pay the...
Unless they're already enrolled in our existing charity care program through the process where they do become eligible for our charity care program, it works its way through that process.
Well, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Murphy brought up, you know, made a comment about being residents of Minnesota for 30 days in order to be eligible for GAMC. And so then I'm just a little bit puzzled. Why are you providing that care to that 30% of people? I mean, how can it go through GAMC if they are not?
No, it's...
Mr. Mahoney.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it would be strictly charity care.
Wow. Okay. So you're really doing a good service not only for Minnesota but for neighboring states, and that's extremely generous. And yet, and on top of that, you know, when a fee or a tax is paid, it isn't free, as we all know. It comes from the people who do pay for services. So they are the ones who are actually paying that charity care or that tax on the charity care.
Mr. Chair, as the individual from Mayo said right before me, you're right, there's a limitation to that, and to some extent this must get passed through to maintain our own viability.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we should get universal coverage.
The universal answer, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, I thank Representative Broad.
Last question. Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, we can also learn from our friends to the east who tried to do that at a cost of $18 billion. And so if we find $18 billion lying around, we can sure take a look at that.
Which we're paying anyway.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Mahoney. And next we'll go to Dr. Penny Wheeler from Alina. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Penny Wheeler. I'm a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist and serve as Alina's chief medical officer. Alina includes 11 hospitals, 70 clinics. We have 24,000 employees and are really proud to care for one out of three Minnesotans. Our staff is exceptional, and they serve our patient in the most effective and efficient way possible. I'm here today to talk also about the coordinated care delivery systems model passed last month for Minnesota's most vulnerable population. For the past several weeks, Alina has spent considerable time and, quite honestly, quite a bit of angst trying to understand how the law would work and how we might implement it. We have identified barriers to a successful implementation of the CCDS by June. First, let me be clear. It's Alina's mission to take care of all patients regardless of ability to pay, and we will continue to do exactly that. We take that obligation very, very seriously and are committed to providing exceptional care, whether through a model like CCDS or in partnership with others or through charity care. Secondly, I have to applaud the efforts made by legislative champions from all sides to try to address the continued support of the GMAC population. We recognize the difficulty that the state faces fiscally and know that this compromise, while imperfect, reflects those constraints. Three of Alina's 10 Minnesota hospitals would be eligible for CCDS participation. Those three are Mercy Hospital in Anoka County, Abbott Northwestern in Hennepin County, and United in Ramsey County. As we consider the feasibility of establishing a CCDS in one or all of those sites, we asked ourselves and our industry colleagues and DES the following questions. And this in these questions is some of the clarity that's needed to know whether we can proceed. Can we implement the changes envisioned by this law by June 1st and still provide exceptional care? Does the CCDS model allow the benefit set, patient choice, and the amount of care provided to vary from one CCDS to another? In other words, does it create a two-tier or maybe even multiple-tier system of care that is really fair and equitable to patients? What documentation will DHS require for reimbursement, or will it be possible to do so electronically through our current system? Or will there be added administrative expenses to treat these patient claims apart from all others? What data is available to a CCDS to effectively manage the care of a population? Doing so for a capitated population requires information across the care continuum and to be able to do it as effectively. What data will we have available for us to do that? Would creating a CCDS impede our current efforts to change our care model and incorporate the payment reforms passed by the state in 2008 or even the recent federal reform? Can we do all these activities well? Would a CCDS be responsible to contract with other hospitals? That's been raised today. Other physicians, other providers? What additional costs would be incurred to take on the role of a health plan? Would a CCDS be responsible to pay the claims of other hospitals, physicians, and providers out of the grant? What happens when the grant runs out? Without a stop loss or reinsurance, how do we measure and plan for our liabilities? As you can see, these are really complicated and very important questions. After a thorough analysis, we are not confident that the CCDS model, as crafted, assures patients and providers a means to maintain and improve the health at a reduced cost. We're concerned that attempting to pilot coordinated care with the GAMC population under this design with this funding will not only fail, but actually could jeopardize our other efforts that Allina has underway to address these concerns. I'm really saddened to make these statements. The principle at the heart of this effort, linking the health of a population to provider payment, is one we wholeheartedly endorse. Align understands the more affordable we make care and the healthier our communities become, the better we are at serving our mission. Earlier in this session, I had the opportunity and the pleasure of talking to you about Align's work to address healthcare disparities. And in January, some of you visited Abbott Northwestern to learn more about our work to redesign our care model. It's all good and promising work that centers on the Institute for Healthcare Improvement's triple aim of making certain that we improve the healthcare of a population, improve the patient experience, and reduce cost. We're learning that these efforts work and where to make investments and where to improve efficiencies. Essentially, we're learning how to make future accountable care work for our patients, providers, and the community. It would be unfair for me to simply criticize the work done to address the GAMC challenge without offering our ideas. We strongly believe, as do others who have testified before me, that the right answer is to early enroll this population into Medicaid. Coupled with the forms that would pay us to provide better health outcomes for this population, Medicaid would provide a fair and consistent benefit to the lowest income Minnesotans, broader access, and patient choice. It would allow all providers to focus our energy on building scalable reforms for the entire Medicaid population. I really appreciate the opportunity today to testify before this committee, Mr. Chair, and would welcome any questions.
Any questions for Dr. Wheeler? Representative Abler.
So none of your hospitals are going to do this?
We cannot accomplish it. We've made the assumption that we cannot accomplish this by June 1st. So none of our hospitals will enroll for June 1st. We'll continue to evaluate it as we get further clarity on all the questions answered and look in ways to do it creatively or with partners if feasible. But we determined it was impossible for us to do so by June 1st.
I'll leave it at that.
Other questions? I don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony. And next is Lori Massa, the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing our state's 147 hospitals and 17 health systems. Despite the diversity of our hospitals and health systems, the MHA membership is united behind and strongly supports early Medicaid enrollment for the population under 75% of the federal poverty guideline. We urge policymakers to enact this early Medicaid option as soon as possible. This would provide comprehensive, meaningful coverage for all of the general assistance medical care population, as well as for some of the single adults currently enrolled in Minnesota Care. While MHA really does appreciate the legislative support and hard work that you all went through in passing the GAMC legislation, we believe it is a temporary solution at best and contain some troubling aspects that could be avoided if early Medicaid enrollment is adopted. The new GAMC program falls far short of the Medicaid program, both in terms of providing an established benefit set and broad network of providers for the recipients of care, as well as predictable and ongoing payment rates for all healthcare providers. First and foremost, we need to keep in mind that all of this population will be covered by Medicaid in October 2013 under the current federal law. So the question for legislators is not whether to cover this population through Medicaid, but when to cover them. Therefore, considering the early enrollment option, I encourage you to take into account the administrative costs and dollars that will go into creating and maintaining a new and inherently temporary and problematic GAMC program. The new GAMC program, especially when compared with the potential of covering its eligible residents in Medicaid, raises significant questions and concerns, as has been testified to earlier this afternoon. From the patient's perspective, there is no statewide guaranteed benefit set under the new GAMC bill, and practical access to care will be extremely limited in many areas of the state, since many providers will not be paid at all. From our hospital's perspective, the payment levels are unsustainable, and contracting and reporting requirements are burdensome, and there is enormous financial risk associated with choosing to become a coordinated care delivery system. Because facilities intending to become a CCDS must respond to the Department of Human Services by the end of today, we don't know for sure which hospitals will express a preliminary interest in doing this. I do know that our eligible members have thoughtfully considered the CCDS option, and many have raised questions and concerns with the Department of Human Services. For example, not knowing how many individuals will be assigned to them as a CCDS, or for that matter, how many GAMC recipients may voluntarily choose that CCDS, what will they initially be paid, and what will the will that allocation be reduced if more hospitals choose to become a CCDS at a later point in time? What will they owe in terms of the prescription drug payback, and how will they bear the risk of being the insurer and provider of last resort for fulfilling their missions and commitment to the larger communities they serve? If there are no coordinated care delivery systems outside the metro area, what does that mean for access to care for patients in those areas? Will patients be expected to travel long distances to get the services they need? Hospitals will always meet their obligations to provide emergency services, but what about non-emergency services or care provided outside the hospital setting? Who pays for emergency transportation services to a CCDS? Would that be billed to the uncompensated care pool, or are those costs absorbed by the CCDS? What about transfers between hospitals where neither provider is a CCDS? For other members, those who know they cannot accept the inherent risk and liabilities of the CCDS model, there are obvious questions and concerns about their role in the new program. The uncompensated care pool is temporary and is a far cry from the actual costs these hospitals and health systems will bear in treating GAMC patients. The uncompensated care pool is temporary and appears that it will have more hospitals participating in it than initially anticipated. So uncompensated care will undoubtedly skyrocket. Please note that the Minnesota Hospital Association and our members are not opposed to payment and delivery reforms and do not regard the early enrollment option as a move away from reform. To the contrary, we firmly believe that services as well as payment mechanisms under our state's Medicaid program do not have to be delivered as they're delivered today. And in fact, the Medicaid program is well positioned to serve as a catalyst for more significant reform. For example, some of our members are interested in developing real accountable care organizations that involve a broader population than just the GAMC patients, that are not premised on block grants without regard for the number of patients served, and that reflect and align with reform provisions in the federal health care legislation. In summary, there are many unanswered questions. Some things, however, seem certain. The new GAMC program is woefully underfunded, the implementation time frame is short, and we fear that many GAMC-eligible patients may be left without meaningful access to care. Because of the many questions and concerns, I am doubtful that the original goal of 17 CCDSs with 80% of the GAMC population having access to a CCDS will be met. It's easy now in hindsight to point out the shortcomings of the GAMC legislation, and I want to reemphasize our appreciation for the hard work that all of you put in to try to maintain an option for this population. But we know that the GAMC deal was struck when federal health care legislation was stalled. That has changed in the meantime, and we now have a much better option available to us, and we believe that is early enrollment in the Medicaid program. We urge you to move in that direction as quickly as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Questions for Mr. Massa. Representative Abler.
No one else is jumping out there. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's been an interesting couple of years listening to your testimony, Mr. Massa. I'm a little disappointed, frankly. This has been a really challenging problem. And if you look at if you read the state budget forecast, we're looking at a deficit of $5.8 billion plus, however we want to add inflation, coming up. And was this solution ideal? It was far less than ideal. And I'm not here to chastise you, but what I'd rather have you come and say is there's some merit. There's something could work here, but we need 4 fixes. We need 16 fixes. We have to address this transfer issue. We have to address the transfer to Mayo from St. Cloud, think for some novel disease only they fix. we need flexibility. We need a way to collaborate with our peers. And here's our 16-point resolution to what's upon us. And instead, what I hear from your members is because this federal thing came along, we're just going to wait it out. We're going to wait it out till an endless pot of money comes to us in the form of unsustainable federal share of a program that has no cost containment in it whatsoever. And it seems frustrating and not real to me. I practice in the world. I treat the people of the people you see. I don't see a lot of them, but whoever comes, I serve them. I don't get paid for exams in my care. I get paid below the cost of my clinic. And half of them don't really have a card they said they did. So I'm with you in the charity compassion part of this whole thing. But at the end, we have to find a system to make it go. And your organization is the heart of the first line emergency defense. And it was put into your niche, the chance to operate this. I thought it should have been a primary care focus, personally, if I was going to write it. I wouldn't have put your group in charge, not that you're bad at it, just that you're focused on the emergency room, the very thing you're talking about. I would put clinics as the gatekeeper to get to you. And so then you wouldn't have had to work below cost, as you do now for these people. But every person you see under the old plan, you lost money on because it was below your cost. The transitional program, which is paying 37%, is way below your cost even at that. I don't know if the law is going to change. And I'm not in charge. And I'll be one vote out of 134. And at the end, the governor has to agree to change it. And just to give you a hint, I don't think he's very interested in much of a change. And so maybe he is, maybe he's not. I don't even know where he is. I don't talk to him much. But I'm here as one member to try to make it work better for the people that you care about so much. I know in your heart, every group that's testified cares about the people. And so the thought of having four or three of these metro focus things for Regions and Hennepin and who else is going to hop on it isn't what we had in mind. I was hoping Mercy would take a chance, my hospital, and would take a chance and make an offer. And, you know, the commissioner told me that he's looking for offers from hospitals. There's gaps in the law. It happened quick. And when those kinds of things happen, they had to make tweaks. Minnesota Care happened over a period of time, and it's been tweaked and tweaked and tweaked. And so people are kind of happy with that. And so I'm just, you're handy, and you're kind of the leader, so I'm telling you this, and I hope I'm being polite to you. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a time for solutions, not to list all the gaps. I could give you just as long a list when I was reading the bill. But here we are, and it's April 15th, and we have a month left in this legislative session. I got to think there's a list of six or eight fixes we can put into this thing that will address those things, at least remove liability or just say you don't got to do it, as opposed to having nothing. The current law we now have is going to give us, with some small number, a single-digit number of these entities, and in St. Cloud there won't be any. There won't be any in Duluth. There won't be any in Itasca County. And so they're going to all work uncompensated for free. And those who were smart enough to hop in and get all the money, at least they'll have some way. But I got to think there's a way to be creative. We could sit down and come up with some resolution. And maybe it involves something to do with the bill we're going to talk about next. I've not even been briefed on that. You got current law. And so I just urge you, and because I know how smart you are. I know the kind of people you got behind you. I know the people who spoke earlier. They're really smart, and this is their passion in their life. So help us find some way to make it work. Should this other thing not come through that we're going to be talking about next, because you're stuck with reality and the future costs and expenses that Minnesota faces are, there's not going to be the $4 billion fix coming through to soften the blow of 5.8. So I guess that was a speech, not a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Liebling. The command is turn off your cell phone.
No way!
Well, that was a hard one to follow. But Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond to Representative Abler just a little bit. I mean, Representative Abler, I appreciate that you care about this stuff a lot, and you work very hard on this, and often you're a great resource. But, you know, your comment about I'm not in charge and we don't know what the governor will do, you know, I just have to say that any 90 of us in the House that decided that we were going to do something could do it. And if three Republican members decided that there was some way that you, you know, something that you wanted to do, you know, I think that involved getting revenue, because I think those of us on this committee pretty much understand that this is a revenue problem. I mean, it's a system problem, too, and we're all working hard to redesign things and make things work more efficiently and figure out how we're going to deal with the ongoing growth in our elderly population and all of that stuff. We all understand that. But I think most of us know that, you know, that a cuts and all cuts solution is going to be a really bad solution. We had that from last session. We ended up with an all-cut solution. If people take the attitude that the only thing we're going to do and, you know, blame it on the governor, we're going to have an all-cut solution. Representative Abler, three Republican members who decided to join with the Democratic members for some kind of revenue could probably have a lot of influence in that. And so I just don't want to let you off the hook quite that easily, although I know you're well-intentioned, but you know, we need to figure something out here, and we can't just say that the governor won't do it.
Representative Abler.
Well, and it's actually a productive discussion. I, for one, actually was willing to raise revenue at one time, so you know that would make sense to me because I thought it was necessary. My reference to the governor was actually used in the first wave. In the normal conductance of our business, we put a bill together, the governor signs it or not. I was just being practical. And I'll just say my view on raising revenue to do some of this stuff. My people don't have any money. My people aren't as bad off as the people we heard about in Monoman County and in Clearwater County where they're working for $8 an hour. But, you know, there's a whole discussion about what would revenue stuff do to our economy. And I'm frugal. But I think we need to pay what we need to what we decide is valuable. But I'm not convinced every penny in our budget is well spent.
That's right.
We have not spent much time looking at some of those lines to see how could we better do it. And I'm tired of the redesign. I'm tired of the tax cut argument. I've said it in many committees. What we have to do is grow our economy and grow our education and redesign everything. My excitement about this GMC project that we're talking about, back to our point, was that there was some redesign and some potential and some possibility to quit churning the fee-for-service system when there was no incentive to save a penny, but just to do more and more tests or more and more treatments or keep them in the hospital a little longer, because why not? We'll make up some of our costs. And you put people back in medical assistance, you're going to go back to that fee-for-service system. And I thought, finally, the Hennepin County group came forward with their desire to do this kind of an idea, and I jumped on that right off the bat. And I favored kind of having a limitless clinic basis, really within reason, where they could go to they could be offloaded to clinics. And so I'll leave it at that. But I think that if you're short $5 billion, the Senate raised taxes $2 billion last time, you're still short $3 billion. You think the economy can support a $5 billion tax increase and keep anybody working, any job creators here? I mean, that's, to me, we're stuck with finding ways to manage our budget. I favor through redesign. I favor through soft landing at everybody who needs our care. So we're friendly. I admire you a lot. So thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. It's an important conversation. We've had many of them on general assistance medical care over the last few months. You know, the reality is we are facing a $6 plus billion deficit for next year. We are going after federal money to try to patch things up for this biennium, but we haven't talked about what's going to happen next biennium. We had a program, General Assistance Medical Care members, that was costing $1 billion per biennium and growing at 36%. I mean, this isn't about the governor supporting or not supporting a bill, or what three people can do on the minority side of the aisle versus the majority. It has nothing to do with that. We have got to start finding different ways of delivering care to people who need it in this state and across this country. And simply moving people onto MA doesn't get it done. It may patch up some people's finances, although I've heard from both the Minnesota Hospital Association and many other groups here how frustrated they are with low MA payments that don't pay them enough. And so there's uncompensated care from that. So we're sitting here talking about lessers of evils and still facing this huge deficit and looking at spending more money. This approach is going to cost the state of Minnesota more money. Where it's going to come from, I don't know, when we're facing that kind of deficit. So I'm disappointed that more of the conversations are on the table, and not just here today, but throughout this session and maybe even previous sessions, have not been about how to fundamentally change what we're doing so that it is sustainable, so we can keep the promises to the people we're trying to help. And I think if that's part of what Representative Abler is trying to get at, that's something that I would echo as well. You know, we can keep trying to move on to sinking lily pads across the pond and hope we don't sink. But that's not getting us very far. We have to fundamentally change how we're doing this. And of course, now we're trying to figure out how does the federal government change that. And we're all going to figure out how the federal health care passage impacts us, and then at some point try to figure out how Minnesota can reform within that. And in the meantime, we're simply moving further down the road and seeing the numbers increase, and there's no solution. And that's very frustrating.
Well, next we're going to have Representative Broad and then Murphy, and then we're moving on to the next testifier. We have two more to go.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I always find it interesting when we talk about bipartisanship that it seems to me that the new arbiter of what is bipartisan is when a Republican crosses the aisle to vote to raise taxes. I find that interesting. You know, we have all sorts of opportunities to be bipartisan in ways that don't involve raising taxes, and I just simply don't accept. I agree with Representative Abler. I don't think the economy can support that right now. I don't think the people can handle that right now. And so when I look at these, quote, two options that we supposedly have, when the two options to either make draconian cuts, which is what we get told all the time, or raise taxes, it's funny. I was just had in my hand looking through it, there is a third option, and states are using the third option, and we should be looking at the third option. And actually, that's what I was so excited about, the GAMC discussion. The GAMC discussion really was an opportunity for us to do things differently, to start curtailing costs and serving people in a different way, and hopefully serving them well. And obviously, there's some concerns out there that we need to look at. But it really was a place for us to say government cannot continue to do what it has done anymore. The math doesn't work. So how do we do it differently? What is that we should be doing that we're not doing? What is it that we are doing that we shouldn't be doing? And I was thinking about the governor of Washington, who, by the way, is a Democrat. And in 2002, Washington kind of redesigned how they were doing things. And here's a quote, actually, that I just happened to have in front of me. I was looking at it for another reason, but he says, "Why are we so focused on the cuts and not the keeps? They had to reduce 15% of their budget in that year." He says, "What we should do is focus on how not how to cut 15%, but on how to maximize the results produced with the remaining 85%." And that focus on value is, in my view, a greater focus on actually how we curtail costs and how we provide services versus what seems to be a continual focus on who pays. Well, who pays doesn't contain costs. Who pays tells who pays. So if we want to contain costs, and again, with this GAMC discussion, we wanted to get people away from hospitals into clinic settings wherever possible. That was going to contain costs. That was going to create a better opportunities to serve people at the right place, at the right time, at the right cost, at a cost that taxpayers could afford. And so I just reject the idea that there's two options. I think while we need to continue working with this GAMC proposal to make sure that we can get things moving in the right direction, if there's things that we can do to make it work better, let's do that. But to simply chuck it before the ink is dry, to me, misses the point. And so, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to be on a soapbox. I think more people should be reading some of the things that have been done in states throughout the nation that are focused more on results and more on getting value than on just simple across-the-board cuts, which, by the way, just simply don't work.
Last one before we go to the next witness is Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and members, and I came to the committee today with a little bit of a stomach ache, wondering, you know, what the debate was going to be like. Although I knew, I generally knew because I've been talking with a lot of the providers, you know, about where we were. And I think if we are doing our job and doing our job with some courage, it means that we have to look at where we are in time. And we have to be able to say out loud, you know, we did, I do believe, and I'm looking at Representative Dean, we did the best job, Representative Huntley, the best job that we could under the circumstances trying to solve a problem that the legislature in Minnesota believed we should solve. We have a different opportunity before us. GAMC serves, you know, 30 to 34,000 people each month, and they're different. Medical assistance serves over 500,000 people. And if we can step away from sort of the politics of this, and is this the reform that we want, and is this about taxes or not, and just think about the opportunity presented, that if we were able to move together the population served by GAMC into into medical assistance where there's a much larger reach, and we apply our desire to do reform, if we were to look at that idea of total cost of care, which I know a lot of people support at this table and within the healthcare delivery system, we would be able to really see sustainable cost savings across the system, and we would be making real system change. The system change we're talking about, we can't really achieve with such a small population. So I think the challenge for us isn't really about where we have been, but where we're headed. And if we have within the month ahead of us the ability to point the compass in that direction and start taking some steps regardless of our politics, the past politics, and where we're going forward in terms of politics. And I think hearing from the providers and their concerns about the system that we have right now, about the law that was passed, the gaps in terms of access and the lack of understanding means that we have to acknowledge that. I keep saying the truth will set us free, right? We can't keep hiding the fact that there are problems in the law. And if we acknowledge that, I think we can, you know, pull ourselves in a direction of trying to make it better. And so while this has been a difficult hearing, I am really glad for the fact that people came up and said what their concerns are, because without that knowledge, we can't make the right steps forward. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any final comment, Mr. Masson?
Hospitals live in the real world as well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, and other members of the committee. We will do our very best to work with whatever the final outcome is, and Minnesotans will be cared for by Minnesota's hospitals.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have somebody from St. Cloud Hospital. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley and committee members. I am the mystery guest. I'm Jim Davis, Vice President of Operations for CenterCare Health System and St. Cloud Hospital. We are obviously centered in St. Cloud, serving about 15 counties in central Minnesota. And I'm going to part a little bit from my written script because a lot of it you've heard from others already. But I want to say, and I thought I was the last to testify, and so I wanted to say you obviously saved the best for last.
Yes,
and the reason I want to say that is that St. Cloud Hospital has been named a top 100 hospital for the 8th year. Only St. Mary's in Rochester has matched that and exceeded it. And so that award says we're a high value, high quality, good outcome, low cost provider. This year we were also named the top employer in the large employee category for the state of Minnesota. I say that to let you know we're a very sophisticated, high-quality organization, and with all of our best minds focused on this bill and looking carefully at whether or not we could support it, I'm here this afternoon to give you some of the reasons that we cannot function as a care coordinating delivery system. But I'd like to tell you a few of the things we do to support this category of patient already that we think are innovative and helpful. like all hospitals in Minnesota, we accept any patients who come to the ER and provide care. But beyond that, we have follow-up care, urgent care, care coordination in our Mid-Minnesota Family Medicine Clinic, St. Cloud's sliding fee clinic for those from throughout central Minnesota who are uninsured or underinsured. We have access to our behavioral health services and our extensive behavioral health programs for patients throughout our region that include inpatient, partial hospitalization, outpatient counseling, alcohol and chemical dependency. And we have a special outreach program. We don't wait for the homeless to find us. We have a special outreach program called HEAL that goes out to find those folks living under the bridges, to make contact with them, to help them create an access point, to screen them and provide services to them early. To do that requires an annual subsidy of about $7.5 million right now. So these programs used by GMAC recipients have required costly subsidies due to extremely poor reimbursement levels, a problem that we feel is exacerbated by the passage of this reform bill. There is no reform in the GMAC reform bill. It is another 70%+ discount cut to providers like St. Cloud Hospital, who are the safety net for the poorest of Minnesota residents. There is no care model we can create that will deliver the care needed by GAMC recipients at this level of reimbursement. While we fully agree with the wisdom of coordinating care for GMAC recipients, we found after reviewing the statute, the contract language dictated by the Department of Human Services, that we simply cannot participate because of the issues that are created. And a few of those are issues that you've heard, but our list is a little bit shorter than the doctor's, but similar. Tremendous administrative burden dictated by the state. An unlimited liability for unlimited and undefined numbers of recipients. A required scope of services that exceeds services that we provide. And exceptionally low reimbursement rates for those services included in the bill. From an administrative standpoint, CentraCare lacks the personnel and systems to manage the contracting, billing and reporting requirements in the CCDS program, but simply, we're not an insurance company. We estimated that it would cost us many hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop the sophisticated insurance risk management systems needed to comply with the regulation. In contrast with the organizations named in the actual bill, they're either owned by or have significant ownership interests in health plans and have access to that network. We also question the wisdom of spending scarce resources to develop capabilities for a program that will be eliminated in 2014 when its participants will be shifted to the Medicaid program under the federal health reform. As stewards of the resources entrusted to us by the community, we cannot accept the risk of assuming liability for the full range of services included in the schedule of benefits for these patients. We cannot assume risk for services we do not provide, nor can we responsibly assume risk for an unidentified and potentially unlimited number of individuals that the state may assign to us if we operate as a CCDS. Staff from the Department of Human Services have indicated that providers will not be allowed to limit their losses. There are no caps allowed in this. We have concluded that the most responsible and prudent course of action for us is to continue to treat the members of our community enrolled in GAMC and limit our losses. We believe the only prudent course of action for the state to pursue is to seek a way to enroll GAMC recipients in the Medicaid program as soon as possible. The opportunity to do so presented by the federal health care reform bill creates an option to address the needs of these patients in a responsible manner. We fully understand that much effort was expended by the legislature to pass this compromise bill, and we appreciate that effort. However, circumstances have changed, and we now have a better option to address the needs of this population. I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to present to you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. David? Yes. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. David, approximately how many GAMC patients do you serve per year in St. Cloud?
We attempted to identify our liability risk with this, and it's hard to do, but our attempt said that if we carved out Benton County and Stearns County as the counties we would cover, that our liability probably would be in the $20 to $21 million area, and we believe the most we will get on any reimbursement is $2 million. So we think there's a 10 to 1 risk. I can't answer specifically your question, although I can get the number to you of the exact number that we're currently serving.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
The Department of Health puts your GAMC load at around 2%, or about 1,200 patients. Does that sound about right?
Dave, do you know? He's our statistician here. I'm sorry. Dave Borgert is our Director of Government Relations at CentraCare.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We served at St. Cloud Hospital in an inpatient setting approximately 1,200 GAMC patients. That is a much more localized group than we would anticipate being responsible for as a CCDS. One of the areas that we're struggling with internally is that we cannot identify the clinic patients outside of the Mid-Minnesota Clinic, which is able to track its contacts with GAMC patients. It saw and maintained care for around 840 individuals over a period of 12 months. And other than that, the number of GAMC patients that might have been seen in CentraCare clinics, our billing systems are unable to separate those, for example, who are being paid for by the PMAP program in prepaid programs through the health plans. We can't separate them out from the Minnesota Care patients or the medical assistance patients who are being prepaid or paid on a managed care contract through the plans. So we've got a fairly finite number in terms of people seen at the hospital, but we're unable to identify the numbers beyond that. Our concern in terms of unlimited risk is that if we proceeded as the CCDS in central Minnesota, we would be the only such hospital south of Duluth and serving all of central Minnesota. So if you look at the potential liability for who might be assigned, we don't know whether we would be asked to provide care for the folks we're seeing now or all of the GAMC patients in our catchment area. And we have some of the same concerns expressed earlier about what happens when we get referrals from other hospitals in the region. And so that's kind of our concern in terms of we have no way of knowing, and the department will not tell us how many people we would be responsible for, though our estimate from the department is we would receive about $2 million.
And Mr. Chair, and I just think that, you know, if St. Cloud doesn't choose to participate, you know, they're taking $2.3 million off the table, assumingly without federal help, is going to be shifted onto the other patients just as your other uncompensated care is. I think that's a little bit unfortunate. But I think to assume that your 1,200 people that you're being asked to care for with $2.3 million is going to somehow quadruple itself or even more than that is not representative of what we see on the ground. We're again solving 80% of 80% of the problem, which I think we have an opportunity to do, and it's just a little bit unfortunate that because of the lure of federal dollars out there that we are seeing a sudden retreat away from what I think would be a very good Minnesota-centered solution moving ahead. But again, with less than 3% of your business, 1,200 folks, $2.3 million seems like It's at least a good start as opposed to uncompensated care, or it, actually, it's not uncompensated care. It's shifted care to the policy holders in the St. Cloud area.
Chairman Huntley and committee members, I think David. That the issue points out that we would like to have had those answers, and we don't, and so you make assumptions and you build a risk assessment around those assumptions. Given there were no others of these CCDS facilities north or west of us, we had to assume that we would be taking in a significant volume of patients. I think one of the problems with this solution also is that these patients find it difficult to travel. We locate our clinic for the underinsured on a bus line because it is a very local situation. And so how these patients will be assigned, how that travel will occur, a lot of uncertainty. But from a perspective of taking this through the boards of directors, we really needed to create some assumptions and then go on that basis, and that was the best we could do.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering, what percent increase did you assume in your assumptions related to the current GAMC population and the population that you assessed should you have gone this direction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad. We had earlier data when a year ago we were talking about this that said that the GAMC program had paid in Stearns and Benton counties approximately $20 million for services. Our assumption was that's below cost, that would be our core market, and we would expect, given our proximity to that population, that liability, that risk, would be the minimum risk. Of that amount, approximately $20 million that we were told had been spent in Stearns and Benton counties, we had received as a hospital approximately $6 million in reimbursements. And so I think that the notion of losing $2.3 million is really in exchange for assuming three times as much risk as we would have had before. It's a fair assumption, I think, since the department has said the assignments will be made by county, that you would assign the people from Benton County, which has no hospitals, whose largest core of population lives within the city of St. Cloud. We're likely to get them. We're also likely to get the vast majority of GAMC recipients from Stearns County. So we were really working, even on our best projection, with a fairly large expansion of risk for us, for no real significant difference in reimbursement that we might expect to get from the uncompensated care pool.
Representative Broad.
Just one quick follow-up. Thank you. I appreciate that information. So if you assumed the population, geographical population, and the amount of reimbursements that were going currently into that geographical population, if I'm understanding you correct, did you assume any cost savings from the change in how we deliver the services, or the potential change in how to deliver the services in a more cost-effective way? Were those cost savings built into that at all in terms of your assessment of the risk?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, yes, they were. It's a little harder to tie down. Mr. Davis related earlier that we already do case management for these people. We go out and get them. We try to get them into a clinic setting, and we manage, in many cases, diabetes and chemical dependency problems in an outpatient setting, or at most a partial hospitalization setting, which is much lower cost. So we're already doing that. And even at that, we did not. I think that Mr. Davis probably put it, there's no way that for 10 cents on the dollar of cost, we can possibly reduce the cost of providing care for this population enough, unless we simply don't provide care. And that's kind of antithetical to everything we exist for. When they show up and they're in pain, or they've been injured, when they're having a diabetic shock, we're going to take care of them. That's what we're there for. So, and I think I want to also state that we intend to continue to serve the people we have served. I think as we have served them, which is as cost effective as we can make it, we've tried different strategies in our emergency room to divert, and it's the Minnesota Department of Health that has said we can't do that because it violates the law. We've tried to redirect people in different programs, and there are limits to what we can do based on both state and federal law that make it difficult for us to do some of the things we could do if we had a little bit more ability to be flexible with these folks. So within the constraints of the system as it exists for us today and the people we're serving, we don't believe we can gain enough efficiencies by diverting people, one, because we're doing a lot of it now, that we can make a lot of gains to the cost of serving these people.
And
Representative Broad.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that was on purpose, but, you know, I'm interested in the statement that you just make, because I think it actually points to a problem that we have in government, is that, you know, you're trying to innovate as a group. You're trying to do these things, and guess who gets in the way? Government. And so, you know, I mean, why is it that we're not saying, okay, let's give you some freedom and flexibility to do some of these unique things, to do some of those new things? And this is why I'm so concerned about a federal health care model, is that, you know, we have how many requests for waivers and plans that are sitting on a desk somewhere out there. And so it just seems to me that we ought to be looking at what are the things that are in the way now that would allow you to do some things better. And I really appreciate, you know, hearing about one of those today. I think that makes a very good point to us here in the state, is what regulations are actually causing more difficulties, causing more cost to the systems that are out there trying to serve people in a cost-effective way. So I appreciate your statements.
Yeah. You know, I think the failure of what we did is that these kinds of groups that we're trying to set up work for a defined population. But they don't know what the population is. And so there, we try to put the insurance risk on them. And when we talk about accountable care organizations in the next couple of weeks, they have a defined population. There's an insurance company that carries the insurance risk. And all these providers can't also be insurance companies and carry that risk.
Chairman Huntley and Committee Member Broad, I really am encouraged by your interest in providing some flexibility. I just want to share a brief story that in our substance abuse programs, we have care for moms, and we wanted to be able to have the kids with the moms through the treatment. And it took us 3.5 years to get the authorization through the state to do that, because it had never been done before. It's an amazing difference in being able to keep those patients through the treatment and come out the other side, and the kids and family get treatment together. So I agree. We need to find, and this law does not really contain reform in how we deliver, and so we're left with the risk. The city of St. Cloud is actually in 3 counties. As a city, we have both Benton, Stearns, and Sherburne counties. So as we try to figure out what is our pool, who do we serve, and they talk about counties, we're a little bit schizophrenic about that as well.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm encouraged with the discussion that we're having here as a committee, and Representative Broad and Representative Gottwall and Representative Dean. I agree we need to do things differently, and we need to have the flexibility in the system in which we allow our local providers to determine how they can best serve the community in an efficient way and in a unique way, because every community is a little different. And the uniqueness that we have in central Minnesota, especially under the GAMC bill that we have now, is the large geographic area that they're going to be responsible for and the unknowns associated with that. We have to come to a realization and first, we need to realize we're not all experts up here as elected officials. That might be the most difficult thing for us to do. Secondly, rely on the expertise of those who, in their day-to-day work, apply our dictates and what we do here in the legislature. And from what I'm hearing is that even with the hard work of Representative Murphy and Representative Dean, that this is simply not working for the majority of providers in the state. And that's a reality, whether we like it or not. And with the blood, sweat, and tears that have been put into it, that's difficult to accept. And I've supported along the process all the GAMC proposals that we had before us and, you know, the urgency of trying to get something done. But I hope we can recognize that this isn't working, that we need to try to find some other better alternative to get us through the next few months, 18, 24, 36 months, so our providers can continue to give care and not be substantially burdened with the financial cost with it. And if we continue the discussion right now, I think we can get some progress done. But I don't want to use, you know, those examples of, you know, waste here and inefficiencies here and over bureaucracy here as being the prohibitive factor of us getting anything done. Because we can always give an example. It could be done better here, or we shouldn't be spending money there. But that shouldn't cloud us for the overall goal that we have. So I hope that, you know, as we release our bill, as we talk about other options for our state, that we can have a constructive dialogue and not let, you know, the few examples cloud the overall goal and take the expertise that we've seen here today from the hospitals and try to do them well.
Representative Broad,
thank you,
then
Mr.
we got to move on.
Yep. This is actually the most important thing that I've said all day. I'm sure you find that hard to believe. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean shouldn't have just left, but I wanted to let the committee know that on April 15th, 1960-something, I won't tell you what it is, he actually came to be, and so it is Representative Dean's birthday today. And so he knew I was going to do this, so he escaped. So if the committee members should make sure that they give him a little pat on the back, that'd be great.
Representative Giffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, I'd also, I'm sure Representative Dean is excited to know his birthday falls on the same day of the DFL's
That's
birthday.
Exactly. He was first to it.
Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having a post-December birthday before New Year's, I never get to have such enjoyment of being in these situations. It really helps a lot. Thank you to my mother. At any rate, thank you. Happy birthday, Representative Dean.
Is that why I came back?
I hate to say it, but just in time. Well, Mr. Chairman, and I went through this and taking your notes, I found a somewhat of a contradiction, though, and it was just kind of puzzling. Because on the one hand, saying you can't do it and giving numbers going other ways, and yet it's like if you don't know the numbers, how do you know you can or can't? I mean, that the fundamental issue and the questions that we've had is the numbers or the assumptions. And on the one hand, and I see it being somewhat of a contradiction, that how can you know either way if you don't have some of those underlying numbers to tell you where you're at? I mean, those are real core things in making decisions about, like you said, the value of going forward or not. And I think secondly is that if you do have a mind or you don't care for it, and I hear a lot of diligence, I hear a lot of due diligence and a lot of efforts that was going on there to do that, but nonetheless, I remember some of the fiscal note discussions we've had, that on occasion the fiscal notes are a bit feeling they're skewed, you know, one way or the other, or later proved to be dramatically different, either under or over. And so you have a vested interest in this situation, so it's always a challenge. But both the fact that if you don't know either way, then how can you say you can or can't? And then secondly, that the numbers that are coming here, I would really be hoping for current law, which has been brought up before, a list of things that said if you fix this, that would really help. In other words, the unlimited insurance situation or the transportation or some of those things that at this time anyway are certainly fixable, because you're taking a really big risk if we don't do some of that. There's a plan A and maybe a plan B, but you're the real ones that have gone through it more than any of us have. So you probably know exactly where there are those things that we can do, and I'd certainly want to have them from you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Giffmeyer, at this particular point, yes, we know that either way we are going to lose. Okay? The question I think that we were forced to address is, based on what information we had, the best information we had to try and divine how we would minimize our losses. And not accepting unlimited risk for an undefined and unlimited number of people is one way. Not accepting liability to pay for services that we cannot provide but that are part of the benefit set, that's another fairly significant barrier. And I think as we read through the contract that came from the Department of Human Services, there are reporting requirements that I'm not certain we require of the health plans that are providing PMAP. Detailed information on a quarterly basis on exactly what was happening with individual patients identified as individuals, and a responsibility to collect that information from other providers who we would have to contract with, who may or may not be able to provide us with that information. There's an administrative burden here, even beyond the risk, that we determined was simply very, very costly and that would eat up a significant percentage of what reimbursement we might get. So that would be another piece, that you could do to address. My final piece is, with respect to the information, is if the Department of Human Services really wanted us to be able to respond well to a request for proposals, then it would have helped us greatly to say, this is the population that you will be expected to serve, this is how much money you will receive for doing it, and we're not going to add to that. This is defined. You can limit your risk so you know what you're up against. When we're told that we have to accept whoever is assigned in the future, in addition to those who choose us, that's kind of so wide open, we really can't work with it. So the data would have been helpful. If we had known what we were up against, we would have certainly looked at it in that light.
Representative Kiffmeyer, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I really appreciate what you've shared in that regard, because the law is as it is written, and those here at the table and the rest of the members that put that law in place also have the authority to change those things or to give that kind of direction. And so I think, again, with some of the, I agree with you that you have to make decisions based on the information at hand and laws as written. But you're speaking to the body during this time that can make those changes. And so I would hope that we as members would take to heart and not just give a either or, but that we have the opportunity to change this law so that it may be more acceptable, and especially I think the intention was certainly to give you the flexibility and to have that, and I think that is a fair and right expectation, and I think it was more of our intent to give you that kind of ability to do that. I would call that legislative intent. Now, if in its going forward it's not doing that, then, Mr. Chairman, I think we need to revisit the subject and would be able to maybe consider fixing that. So thank you for your information.
Mr. Chair and committee, I wanted to say this earlier, but your question is right on target. As I raised my children, when they had to know right now, the answer was no. We had to sign today, and we had no information. All of the stuff that we needed to know to assess the risk, we didn't have. There was no other answer but no. And I sympathize with you, and we would be glad to have more dialogue with you to help define those questions that we labored with, because we're a faith-based provider. We really focus on this panel of patients. We are committed to them and always have been. But given the information we had and the potential risk at hand, we had no other answer but no.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. And the last on this particular topic is the president of the Minnesota Medical Association. And after that, we're going to have a very brief presentation of the fiscal note for the early enrollment. Okay, and I, Mr. Greenman has got a family and a couple of kids, so he needs to spend some time with them. So if we can stay away from the political questions, just keep it on what the details of the fiscal note are, that would be a good thing to do. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley and members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Witten. I'm a physician specializing in internal medicine. I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA has a long-standing commitment to achieving universal coverage for all Minnesotans. We applaud the many members of the House and Senate who worked long and hard to craft an alternative proposal to preserve coverage for JMC enrollees and to protect Minnesota's safety net providers. Unfortunately, the sigh of relief that many of us breathed following passage of the GMC fix now has many of us again gasping for air. The MMA does not believe that the coordinated care delivery system based model for serving the GMC enrollees is sustainable, realistic, or in the interest of patients. The financial investment in the program will not cover the health care needs of the patients. Access and care will suffer. Some of the reform elements in the proposal, the CCDS idea in particular, are not real reform. There is, however, increasing discussion and interest in the accountable care organization idea that has emerged over the last couple of years. But the CCDS idea lacks many of the core components considered essential for accountable care organization development, including the need to prospectively plan and budget for patients' resource needs. The 2008 Healthcare Reform Act placed significant emphasis on the development of healthcare homes that would deliver patient-centered coordinated care with the goal of improving access to outpatient healthcare and reducing unnecessary use of hospital services. The CCDS model all but eliminates outpatient care for many GAMC enrollees. As such care, as you know, can only be provided if clinics throughout the state are contractually linked to hospitals that choose to become CCDS. As a result, many GAMC enrollees will be without access to many services. The proposal in House File 3713 acknowledges the flaws in the GAMC fix and rightly capitalizes on the opportunity included in the Federal Reform Act to expand Medicaid eligibility to all adults below 75% of poverty, specifically those currently covered by GAMC. The MMA supports the concept of streamlining and simplifying Minnesota's public health care programs, and this proposal accomplishes that at the same time it leverages federal resources. The MMA also supports the option of accessing enhanced federal matching dollars for care coordination services provided by healthcare homes. Finally, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I do need to express reservations about any long-term use of healthcare access fund revenue to finance medical assistance coverage. The MMA recognizes the financial challenges facing the state and further acknowledges that absent any of the previous changes to GAMC, that many individuals could have enrolled in Minnesota Care. That said, the MMA remains firm in its opposition to utilizing provider tax revenue for programs that have otherwise been general fund responsibilities. This includes medical assistance. Given the potential to further reform Minnesota's public health care programs with an eye to full coverage in the year 2014, the MMA looks forward to working with the legislature next year to craft a long-term, sustainable funding mechanism for Minnesota's programs. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, this isn't so much a question as just a sort of a. In 2008, we talked a lot about level three and total cost of care, and had we moved forward with that then, we would be 2 years ahead of ourselves in terms of reform. And I've heard a lot of conversation tonight or expressions of support of the idea of accountable care versus the CCDS model. And so I just wanted to sort of encapsulate that and summarize that if we move forward in that direction, we're going to expect, I'm going to expect as a policymaker, your input on that and then support as we move forward with that, since there seems to be a lot of resonating support for that concept now in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, the MMA will fully partner with the legislature to explore any and all opportunities to further the ability of our physicians and hospitals to deliver services. I'm not unequivocally endorsing accountable care organizations at this time. They're one mechanism, and there are many questions that we have to answer about them, but there's certainly an avenue that needs to be looked at.
And I will say that the 2008 bill grew out of the Minnesota Medical Association and Healthy Minnesota, and we have a very progressive medical community in this state.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Dave Greeman to talk about the fiscal note for one attempt at early entry into medical assistance for people below 75% of poverty. Minnesota is one of 11 states that has the option to do this. Welcome to committee, David.
Thank you. Dave Greeman with the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, how would you like me to do this?
If 15 minutes probably.
Okay.
Go through and tell us the assumptions you made and what the net cost is going to be in each area.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think you have the fiscal note that's been signed off by MMB coming around. Essentially, our understanding of what the bill does, based on the language, is that it expands MA eligibility for adults without kids between 21 and 64 who are not otherwise eligible for MA. And it's got an income limit of 75% of the federal poverty guidelines. And the non-federal share of the cost of the expansion is to be funded out of the Health Care Access Fund. The proposal has an effective date of April 1, 2010. The bill also establishes a series of, or it amends a section of law that has a series of sequential steps that the department is to take under current law to bring the Health Care Access Fund into balance. And these have to do with eligibility issues, disenrollment issues, I should say, premiums. And if the Health Care Access Fund were to run a deficit, and the bill specifically eliminates language in that statute that requires the commissioner to increase Minnesota care premiums for adults, for families with children, and to modify some of the insurance barriers. And then the bill also prohibits the department from taking any of the remaining steps to adjust, if there's a deficit, of the Health Care Access Fund until July 1 of 2014. The bill makes a number of specific transfers from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund and repeals the modified GMC program that was part of Chapter 200, that was Chapter 200, passed earlier this session. In clarifying some things, we did talk to staff and made some some of our assumptions on those discussions. One was that this language would be a delete everything amendment. It wasn't clear in the language, but that's our assumption at this point. And that the laws repealing the section that repeals Chapter 200, the GMC program that establishes the GMC program, would be limited. That section would be amended to only repeal the provisions dealing with the establishment and the funding of the GMC program, not the other provisions in the bill that provide savings and other. There's a mental health consult provision in the bill. We're assuming that that's going to stay in the bill, or that law is not going to be repealed, I should say. And I know this has been an issue of some consternation, but our position is that at this point we cannot implement this prior to January 1 of 2011. Because of the systems work that's involved, because we're still getting guidance from CMS. So what we are assuming is that it's going to have a January 1, 2011 effective date, and that the GMC program will be operational until January 1 of 2011, and we did talk to the legislative staff about that. And then finally that we would not have started work on making the changes to GMC eligibility in our systems that we're otherwise we would be making under current law. Basically, this fiscal note assumes that these amendments will be made to the bill, and that's what our fiscal note's contingent upon. Let's see. Some of the assumptions we made are that aren't clearly laid out in the bill. One is that individuals who are legally in the U.S. who would otherwise be eligible for MA but for their immigration status will be enrolled in state-only funded MA, which is current law. I mean, there's a separate provision of law that says that those folks get MA with state-only funded. And we're assuming that that's, since the bill doesn't address that's going to happen. We're assuming it's going to be provided through a mixture of fee-for-service and managed care, and that Minnesota Care adults without kids who are eligible for this new MA benefit will transition over about a six-month period. Let's see. And finally, sort of the last item has to do with the Health Care Access Fund. We, under current law, the Health Care Access Fund has a positive balance of $59 million in fiscal year 11. And the way the bill is structured, we believe that the bill is structured so as not to affect the balance of the Health Care Access Fund. There will be enough there's adjustments and savings and transfers from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund each year that will keep the balance as it is in current law. So, and we're assuming a $59 million balance in fiscal year 11 with this bill, a positive balance. We are assuming that the bill will go into, or the Health Care Access Fund will go into deficit starting in fiscal year 12, and the deficit will grow in fiscal year 13 to about $409 million at the end of fiscal year 13, which is what we're forecasting under current law as well. I can walk through the numbers now if you'd like. Would that be helpful?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Although I did notice on the first page that there's, it looks like there's savings in the number of employees it would take to.
There is. Because there are, our Minnesota Care enrollment's going to go down, we forecast Minnesota Care operations staffing levels based on Minnesota Care enrollment. And so we're assuming that that we'll need less staff. And so there's a savings to that piece right there. We're assuming that we'll be reducing staff by, I believe, about 13 people at the end of fiscal year 13. So,
Mr. Chairman, would that also mean that there might be a corresponding increase in another area to accommodate this new population?
Representative Kiffmeyer, Mr. Chair, the MA eligibility is determined by the counties, as opposed to in the Minnesota Care eligibility is determined by DHS staff who are part of Minnesota Care operations. So this would increase the number of people whose eligibility would be determined by the counties.
So we might be passing this on to a county structure then, if they would be adding more?
Currently, MA eligibility is determined by the counties. So.
And Mr. Chairman, I do understand that. I think my question is more that then the counties may have to hire more people to do more of this work. Is that the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's possible, yeah.
Right.
Mr. Greenman.
Okay. I guess I'd start on page 3, and this is sort of the high-level fiscal summary, and if people have more questions, I can certainly go into more detail. In terms of the general fund, what's happening in the bill is the bill currently repeals GMC, and we're assuming it's going to be January 1 of 11. So on the top line, we're taking savings from the elimination of GMC, and that's a savings to the general fund. But under the provisions in the bill, the savings from the elimination of the repeal of the GMC program gets transferred to the Health Care Access Fund. And so that's where that second line comes in. It's going to the Health Care Access Fund. The bill makes specific appropriations or transfers from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund each year. I can start, I guess, on the next line. The top line shows the savings from to the Health Care Access Fund from not from having folks transition from Minnesota Care to the MA program. So that's the savings each year for that. The next line down.
By the way, if you don't, we should have handed that out because I don't know if you've got it before, but there is a sheet that shows the enrollment of adults without children in Minnesota Care, and there's about 25,000 of them that are below 75% of poverty. Actually, there's about 16,000 that are below 25% of poverty. So if they shifted the MA, then that saves the Health Care Access Fund something.
The next line down is the cost to the Health Care Access Fund of the MA new eligibility or the new coverage for adults without children on medical assistance. The line after that, as you observed, Mr. Chair, is savings to the Minnesota Care operations as a result of lower enrollment in Minnesota Care. That's the staffing and administrative reductions. There are going to be some systems costs associated with the early expansion, and those are shown below that. The revenues to the Health Care Access Fund include the savings from the unspent or from the repeal of the GMC program and the transfer from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund. And then there's a small change in what we receive in terms of federal administrative reimbursement because we get a 40% match on our administrative costs for running the Minnesota Care program, and we lose that 40% match when we reduce expenditures. So the net impact to the Health Care Access Fund in fiscal year 11 is a $71,000 reduction, a $519,000 reduction in fiscal year 12, and a $561,000 reduction in fiscal year 13. And I should say the impact to the health to the general fund is a $40.5 million in net expenditures in fiscal year 11, about $8.6 million in fiscal year 12, and about $16.3 million in fiscal year 13. And I can, if you'd like, at the end of the spreadsheet, the long spreadsheet is more detail and more detail about the savings to the Health Care Access Fund. And I can certainly walk through that as well. But that's sort of the nuts and bolts of the fiscal note.
Representative Abler.
And I realize you're just kind of give the high level here, but can you tell me on page 5 of the fiscal note, it talks about just trying to get the mass of this toward the, these aren't numbered, but on the in the middle of the page, it goes into the header GMC population and the numbers in 12 and 13, $489 million and $540 million. Are those the numbers that are being spent on services for these this program?
That's the impact of the GMC population shifting over to the MA program.
Right. That's the total amount of
services. Those are the net costs.
Yeah, so a billion or so.
That's a state and federal. Those are both state and federal dollars.
State and federal. All right. And so there's about $1 billion in spending state and federal for those 2 years to serve. I mean, nominally, I'm just trying to get. My question is, how can you match even half that much for only $15 million. I mean, the state cost is in 2012 and 2013 is a total of about $24 million or so.
Yeah, let me explain what we're doing here.
Where's the golden straw here?
Good side and the bad side to what we're proposing.
You got the machine working.
We are currently spending, and you know, if I'm way off, David, you can correct me, but about $500 million of state money on this population right now. Okay. And if they go into MA, and at the federal level, the cost would be roughly $2 billion. Okay? Feds will pay half of that. So our costs will have to go from $500 million up to a billion or another $500 million. And what we're doing in this proposal is we're showing that as a deficit in the health care access fund. And that's the bad part of it. Law requires us to have a balanced budget in the general fund. It does not require us to have a balanced budget in the health care access fund. And so the health care access fund will go into deficit in 2012 under this proposal. It will go into fiscal deficit in 2012 under the governor's proposal. But we are building up the deficit, and as when we were going to adjust things so that the deficit will be no worse than what's in current law, which is $409 million in fiscal year 2013.
Mr. Chairman, so the difference is you're extracting out the federal share, and that's how you get the enhanced stuff.
So we would put $500 million. Ultimately, estate money, if we come up with it, and we would get $1 billion of federal money.
And the healthcare access fund forecast was based on after the GAMC work.
Yes.
That the 409, and it's in the bill, which is your bill's getting shorter all the time. The three-page bill now, the three-page omnibus. Is it prudent then to take away management options in the Minnesota care deficit plan, that you can't increase premiums and you can't do these things? Is there a reason you would take those options away and just have a
ultimately the governor could unalive probably. And let me explain. This is you can criticize all you want me on this one, but in January next year, when we come back here, we'll be dealing with fiscal year 12 and 13, and the out biennium will be 14 and 15. Then we're not dealing with 14 and 15 this year, and the 14 and 15 year ought to look very good because the feds will pick up 100% of the cost of these for, I don't know, 5 years or something. And there are ways that I don't understand, and we'll have to have John Walls at some time explain it to us, that if you're looking at a four-year period and you got pretty good money in the third and fourth year, you can shift some of that up front. So my intent would not to be to lay off anybody that's on Minnesota Care, even though it would look like we would have to do that in this current budget.
So, Mr. Chairman, we're looking at a massive, massive shift, what it amounts to, in order to technically comply with a balanced budget?
I mean, this population over the next 3 years, if they go into MA, will be $2 billion, I guess. And in the next 2-year period, the cost will be the same, but the feds will pay all of it.
Mr. Chairman, I thought that the Health Care Access Fund, that when it ran into deficit, automatically pulled from the general fund. So wouldn't that...
That terminates at the end of fiscal year 11. That law that says
current
that...
Current law?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Well, because that was the one thing that didn't quite add up.
So after that point, there's no requirement that the general fund make up a deficit in the Health Care Access Fund.
At that point, Mr. Chairman, would the Health Care Access Fund with the provider fee end as well?
Not at that point. I mean, we're not talking about that today, but my position, which the Senate may or may not support, would be to end the provider tax in 2014. And this is getting off the fiscal note here, but
we're all enjoying the discussion, right?
And let me explain. In the federal law, you know, whether you like it or not, and I don't think it will be overturned by the courts, there will be everybody up to 133% of poverty will be covered by the feds, adults without kids, 100% by the feds. And the feds will also supply subsidies for people based on basically the same sliding fee scale that we have in Minnesota Care, only the feds will make those subsidies.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at some time the people still have to pay.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can go the other way on this. David, you got anything more?
No, I...
David, in the middle of page 5, one of your assumptions is that HMO rates are 20% higher than historic GAMC rates?
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain that?
I think historically we have paid rates, higher MA rates than GAMC. One of the issues involved is getting CMS to certify our rates, and we do need to go to an actuary, make sure they're actuarially sound. And I believe has to do with that. And also, I believe it has to do with the benefit set as well. The benefit set for MA is more comprehensive than GMC.
Mr.
Representative Abler.
So this is interesting and novel, and we'll discuss it, I'm sure, some more. Is the department, is this like actuarially sound as far as it, I mean, are you guys, is this something the department is liking? And really, is this not part of the budget, but is this actuarially sound, and is this...
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Greenman.
You understand my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I guess what I would say is that this bill does cover the cost of the GMC program, or excuse me, the MA early expansion in fiscal year 11, and leaves the Health Care Access Fund with a positive balance. It does run a deficit in fiscal year 12 and 13, and under the provisions of the bill, this is something that there isn't funding to cover the cost in fiscal years 12 and 13, and this is something the legislature, under the provisions of the bill, the legislature will need to take action. That we don't have the authority to do anything about the deficit, and what the bill does is gives us the authority to, well, the opportunity to provide recommendations to the legislature about how to bring the Health Care Access Fund back into balance. Historically, I think when there has been a deficit in the Health Care Access Fund in out bienniums, we do have the authority to take some action in terms of stopping new enrollment and disenrolling people, raising premiums, but we haven't historically taken that action. If it's in the next biennium, we've given the legislature the opportunity to fix it before we would take action.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just one more question. Just the food for thought department. At some point, we're going to have to address the deficit in 12 and 13 in the bigger scheme. Is this going to limit our ability to do that? Right now, we're limited because of maintenance effort requirements from doing many things that actually are reasonable to do by limiting care to people who have a much lower need and focusing on the high needs. Is this going to tie our hands, some do you think? And if you don't know, you can find out. But it seems like it's the thing that we should keep in mind as we go ahead with this. So, thanks.
Anything else for Mr. Greenman? We're all speechless. Thank you, Mr. Greenman, for your work on this. And is this now the official note? It's not preliminary anymore?
No, this is the official fiscal note. But as with other fiscal notes on this subject, we continue to get more information about what we can and can't do under this MA Early expansion. And one of the things we need to look at is whether one of the assumptions we made is that this fiscal note is based on the GMC benefit set, and it's not clear that we can use the GMC benefit set, whether that meets federal approval for getting a federal FFP. And if we did have to use the MA benefit set, that would increase the cost of the bill. There would be about a 7% increase in the cost.
Okay, thank you. Representative Abler is going to move the...
all of them, Mr. Chair.
...minutes of March 24th, March 25th, and what's the other one here? April 6th. Any discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes, and again, thank you for your... some of us have stayed to the bitter end here. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.